which is going to be also optional should we have time problems. But let's start with chapter 1, which will set the scene. It's about the two armies which are assembling at the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So you have your Bhagavad Gitas in front of you, and we are all going to chant in unison. Dhritarashtra said, O Sanjaya, after my sons and the sons of Pandu assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do? Sanjaya said, O King, after looking over the army arranged in military formation by the sons of Pandu, King Duryodhan went to his teacher and spoke the following words. O my teacher, behold the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, the son of Drupada. Here in this army are many heroic bowmen, equal in fighting to Bhima and Arjun, great fighters like Yuyudhana, Virata and Drupada. There are also great heroic powerful fighters like Drishtaketu, Chekitana, Kasiraja, Purijit, Kantiboja and Saibya. There are the mighty Yudhamanyu, the very powerful Uttamauja, the son of Subhadra and the sons of Draupadi. All these warriors are great chariot fighters. There are personalities like you, Bhishma. But for your information, O best of the Brahmanas, let me tell you about the captains who are especially qualified to lead my military force. There are personalities like you, Bhishma, Karna, Kripa, Ashwatthama, Vikarna, and the son of Somadatta called Burishwara, who are always victorious in battle. There are many other heroes who are prepared to lay down their lives for my sake. All of them are well equipped with different kinds of weapons, and all are experienced in military science. Our strength is immeasurable, and we are perfectly protected by Grandfather Bhishma, whereas the strength of the Pandavas, carefully protected by Bhima, is limited. All of you must now give full support to Grandfather Bhishma as you stand at your respective strategic points of entrance into the phalanx of the army. Then Bhishma, the great valiant grandsire of the Kuru dynasty, the grandfather of the fighters, blew his conch shell very loudly, making a sound like the roar of a lion, giving Duryodhan joy. After that, the conch shells, drums, bugles, trumpets, and horns were all suddenly sounded, and the combined sound was tumultuous. On the other side, both Lord Krishna and Arjun, stationed on a great chariot, drawn by white horses, sounded their transcendental conch shells. Lord Krishna blew his conch shell, called Panchajanya. Arjun blew his, the Devadatta, and Bhima, the voracious eater and performer of Herculean tasks, blew his terrific conch shell, called Paundra. King Yudhisthira, the son of Kunti, blew his conch shell, the Ananta Vijaya, and Nakula and Sahadev blew the Shugosha and Manipushpaka. That great archer, the king of Kasi, the great fighter Sikandi, Dhristadyumna, Virata, the unconquerable Satyaki, Drupada, the sons of Draupadi, and others, O king, such as the mighty armed son of Subhadra, all blew their respective conch shells. The blowing of these different conch shells became uproarious. Vibrating both in the sky and on the earth, it shattered the hearts of the sons of Dhritarashtra. At that time, Arjun, the son of Pandu, seated in the chariot, bearing the flag marked with Hanuman, took up his bow and prepared to shoot his arrows. O king, after looking at the sons of Dhritarashtra drawn in military array, Arjun then spoke to Lord Krishna these words. Arjun said, O fallible one, please draw my chariot between the two armies so that I may see those present here who desire to fight and with whom I must contend in this great trial of arms. Let me see those who have come here to fight, wishing to please the evil-minded son of Dhritarashtra. Sanjaya said, O descendant of Bharata, having thus been addressed by Arjun, Lord Krishna drew up the fine chariot in the midst of the armies of both parties. In the presence of Bhishma, Drona, and all the other chieftains of the world, the Lord said, "Just behold, Partha, all the Kurus assembled here." There Arjun could see, within the midst of the armies of both parties, his fathers, grandfathers, teachers, maternal uncles, brothers, sons, grandsons, friends, and also his fathers-in-law and well-wishers. When the son of Kunti, Arjun, saw all these different grades of friends and relatives, he became overwhelmed with compassion and spoke thus. Arjun said, "My dear Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before me in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering and my mouth drying up. My whole body is trembling. My hair is standing on end. My bow, Gandiva, is slipping from my hand and my skin is burning. I am now unable to stand here any longer. I am forgetting myself and my mind is reeling. I see only causes of misfortune. O Krishna, killer of the Kesi demon. I do not see how any good can come from killing my own kinsman in this battle, nor can I, my dear Krishna, desire any subsequent victory, kingdom, or happiness. O Govinda, of what avail to us are a kingdom, happiness, or even life itself, and all those for whom we may desire them are now arrayed on this battlefield. O Madhusudana, when teachers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, maternal uncles, fathers-in-law, grandsons, brothers-in-law, and other relatives are ready to give up their lives and properties and are standing before me, why should I wish to kill them, even though they might otherwise kill me? O maintainer of all living entities, I am not prepared to fight with them, even in exchange for the three worlds, let alone this earth. What pleasure will we derive from killing the sons of Dhritarashtra? Sin will overcome us as if we slay such aggressors. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune, and how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? O Janardana, although these men, their hearts overtaken by greed, see no fault in killing one's family or quarreling with friends, why should we, who can see the crime in destroying a family, engage in these acts of sin? With the destruction of the dynasty, the eternal family tradition is vanquished, and thus the rest of the family becomes involved in irreligion. When irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become polluted, and from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Rishni, comes unwanted progeny. An increase of unwanted population certainly causes hellish life both for the family and for those who destroy the family tradition. The ancestors of such corrupt families fall down because the performances for offering them food and water are entirely stopped. By the evil deeds of those who destroy the family tradition and thus give rise to unwanted children, all kinds of community projects and family welfare activities are devastated. O Krishna, maintainer of the people, I have heard by disciplic succession that those whose family traditions are destroyed dwell always in hell. Alas, how strange it is that we are preparing to commit sinful acts. Driven by the desire to enjoy a royal happiness, we are intent on killing our own kinsmen. Better for me if the sons of Dhritarashtra, weapons in hand, were to kill me unarmed and unresisting on the battlefield." Sanjaya said, "Arjun, having thus spoken on the battlefield, cast aside his bow and arrows and sat down on the chariot, his mind overwhelmed with grief." So I'm going to follow through with some of these overheads that have been prepared for this presentation. So we are talking about the Bhagavad Gita, the first chapter, the meeting of the armies or gathering of the armies at Kurukshetra. And there is also Arjun and Krishna on the side of the Pandavas on the chariot where Krishna is accompanying Arjun. So this chapter that we heard, observing the armies on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, it is essentially setting this scene, sets the scene of the two armies gathering. There are, we read, 46 verses. And you can roughly divide them into two sets. The first 26 deal with the armies assembling on the battlefield and their readiness to fight. They are getting ready to fight. And then the next verse, set of verses from 27 to 42, Arjun speaks as he sees the army. He gets very emotional, and he begins to give his reasons to Krishna, who is on the chariot, for not wanting to fight. Quickly looking through the sequence of what is happening, Dhritarashtra is inquiring. Dhritarashtra is the head of the Kuru dynasty. His sons are on the battlefield. So also are those of his brother Pandu, where Arjuna is leading the charge. On the side of the Kurus, Duryodhan is leading the charge. Dhritarashtra is very curious because he knows that this battlefield of Kurukshetra is a place of pilgrimage. And he also knows that Krishna is on the side of Pandu. So even though his sons are equipped with a great force and great warriors, he's very curious. He's telling Sanjaya that after they assemble, what did they do? That's essentially the question he poses. So Sanjaya then starts relaying the scene. He tells him that Duryodhan, your son, went up to Dronacharya and described to him the strengths and weaknesses of the Kuru army. He was a little bit nervous because Dronacharya had some issues with warriors. And also Duryodhan knew the strengths of the other party. So he is sounding off Dronacharya as to, what do you think? We have these warriors here. On the other side, they also have men like Bhim, archer like Arjun. So he is describing the two armies in this conversation. Then moments pass and conch shells are blown. And then Arjuna takes up his bow and arrow and begins to speak to Krishna to actually move the chariot because he wants to see the two armies. Krishna draws up the chariot in the midst of the two armies so Arjun can see them. And this is when Arjun, upon seeing the armies, gets very emotional. So we are Krishna is drawing up the chariot. We are halfway there. So Arjun sees the army. And upon seeing his friends and relatives, Arjun is overwhelmed with compassion. He becomes soft-hearted. He begins to forget himself. He's unable to stay on the battlefield. And he tells Krishna he sees no good coming out from killing his own kinsmen, his relatives and friends. And he does not desire a kingdom at the expense of their lives. He thinks one would only incur sin by killing the sons of Dhritarashtra. So then he tells Krishna, and there's a set of key verses, as to what would happen to a dynasty when they lose their seniors, when they lose the head of the dynasty or head of the clan. And the next set of verses essentially describe starting from 39 all the way up to 43. Arjun says that destruction of the dynasty would lead to irreligion. There would be degradation of womanhood and unwanted progeny would result. With unwanted children, all kinds of community projects and family welfare activities will be devastated. So these are some of Arjun's fears. And these are some of the consequences that Arjun is pointing out to Krishna. He says that he has heard that those who destroy family traditions will end up in hell. Why should I participate in battle if that is what is going to happen? So he questions the logic of killing his own brethren. He casts aside his bow and arrow, sits down on the chariot with his mind overwhelmed with grief. And so this is where chapter 1 ends. So what is significant here? Well, what is significant is to know the mood of this chapter. this conversation that starts between Dhritarashtra and Sanjay. It's important to know the mood that Dhritarashtra is also afraid. He's nervous because he knows Krishna is present. Then the strengths on the two sides, that's important to know. Who is there at the battlefield is important to know. And also, we should make note, we should pay attention to the reasons that Arjun is giving for not fighting. I'd like also to refer, it will be helpful to refer to our notes when this revision is done for the exam, that there are personal reasons that Arjun is giving. He is giving scriptural and social reasons, and one of the main things that he's saying is destruction of family, of dynasty. What are the consequences that are going to come from there? So those are the main points or highlights I had on this. We may have a couple of minutes to consider if there's anything else that you picked up that may be significant on chapter one.
You mentioned that Duryodhan was talking diplomatically, so he was nervous. At the same time, he was very, very diplomatic in talking to Bhishma and Dronacharya. So he's very qualified to be a king. I don't like to fight, and he knows what's going on. And other thing was, I think the Dharma Kshetra word.
Yes, right. That's correct. Yes.
So. It says, yeah, Dharma Kshetra word is very significant because there were a couple of things which we can talk about. One is that I think Srivast Prabhu mentioned in the class, one of the classes, that in Dwapar Yuga, the piety is rewarded through Dharma Kshetra, like Kurukshetra. So that's why it is. At one point, I noted that, and other points which I don't remember.
Yes, that's a good point you bring up about Dharma Kshetra. It is referring to the significance of the place being a place of pilgrimage. Kshetra, you know, is a place, the field, Dharma. So there is this religious activity. And there is another finer point also, that it would be a place that will wipe out all evil elements. So here the message is that Krishna being there is going to see to it that the evil-minded side, be it the Kurus, will be wiped out. It's a place for purging things. And that is there in that purport where Dharma Kshetra comes up. Yes.
Another significance here is that Dhritarashtra is worried that since it's a place of pilgrimage, his sons may get into some compromise with Pandavas, and then stop the war altogether. That is another of his worries.
That's correct. Although he doesn't want them to reach a deal or an agreement, he would like them to just go forward and fight. And he would under no cost give not even an inch of land to the Pandus. This is his determination. Yes.
Hare Krishna. I was thinking about a few words in Sanskrit that might help us in the exam.
Okay.
One is the bow of Arjuna called Gandiva.
Gandiva.
Maybe we should remember that. And
yes.
I was thinking about Gudaka. Gudaka means a person who is... Gudaka means sleep. Mm-hmm. And Arjuna is referred as Gudakesha because he has conquered sleep. And I was also thinking about, the six kinds of aggressors. So that would be a good point to remember. That might be a... might come up in the exam. It's the 36, text 36.
helpful to point out the text for all of those.
Okay, sure. It's the Gandiva. I think it's there in the notes. Yeah. Yeah. 20 text 24 is Gudakesha. The first two lines talk about what is Gudaka and what is Gudakesha. And text 36 is the six kinds of aggressors. I thought that might be one of the questions that we need, for memorization.
Mm-hmm.
Because a poison giver, a person who sets fire, attacks, deadly weapons, yes, in the purport. So I thought that might be one of the things we should remember for the exam. And the conch shells of all the people, especially Krishna and Arjuna, Panchajanya, Rishikesha, and Poundra. So it would be helpful to just remember these conch shells of different people. It might be in the exam.
Yeah.
It's not just for exam, but also I thought that these are some things that we can. It might be helpful for us because we may be knowing it, but just to give an extra focus into it so that we remember that what it is. Yeah, I don't want to take more time. And I have one last thing is Achyuta. I think it's there in the homework. Achyuta means what it means. So I think it's there in the homework. So I'm so sure that people will just go over it. Thank you, Haribol. Infallible.
Yes, those are good points. Thank you very much.
But since our Srivas Prabhu is here, is it even wise to bring up potential questions for the exam?
You know, I thought about that. And the only thing we can count on is that he has already set the paper.
Is that correct? If we have already set the paper, then we can freely discuss the question.
But he will change that. I am in front of the
DVD. That's okay, he wants us to party.
Okay. We have to do our best. As we'll move forward, we'll learn that don't be attached to the results.
Yes. Good to know, because it's not like philosophy is something you read, understand, you'll be able to read onwards. But there's something that you have to, if it's Gandiva, you have to write Gandiva.
You can't take it all, right?
Yes, and we need to point these things out, what we feel is important. Okay, so let's move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 2. Now, this is a long one, and it has double the number of verses, actually has 72 verses. Shall we chant it or shall we go into the summary?
I think summary?
Okay, all right. That will save on the time. Good feedback. So this is really the chapter where after Krishna is hearing Arjun, Krishna will speak to him. chapter has 72 verses, and the first 10, they are those in which Krishna now begins to address Arjun, where he will essentially urge him to fight. Arjun, being still confused, will give more reasons not to fight. But the significant thing is that he will surrender. He will give his reasons, and once again he will come up with more reasons in chapter 2 about what the consequences would be about his brethren being destroyed, and how could he kill his superiors, those who have been his teachers and others. He would have blood on his hand, and he will say, what good is this kingdom with tainted blood? So those would be his arguments. But then again, he will say he's confused. And he will tell Krishna, please instruct me. I am your devotee and I surrender to you. So that is the stage that is set in the first 10 verses. And Krishna will begin to address him. Essentially, Krishna will start by saying that you are speaking words of wisdom, but you don't know that learned men don't grieve over the living or the dead. Because Arjun is grieving. He said, what will happen is people dying and all that. And Krishna points out that in wise men know the difference between matter and spirit, so they don't grieve over the living or the dead. That's the first thing with which Krishna approaches him. And then in the next set of 20 verses, very critical verses of the second chapter, from 211 to 230, Krishna will essentially talk about Sankhya Yoga, the analytical knowledge of the body and the spirit soul. And he will essentially define the spirit soul and talk about the characteristics of the spirit soul. That the living entity truly is this imperishable, indestructible spirit soul, which is its true identity. And in these verses, you'll find all the characteristics of the soul. We will look at one or two which are important. That it cannot be destroyed. It cannot be fragmented. It cannot be moistened. It is immutable. That's what Krishna will say. And so he will say that if it is not killed, it doesn't slay anyone, nor is it slayed. He will point it out. It doesn't kill, nor is it killed in the process. So why grieve over the body that is perishing? And even if you believe that cycles of birth and death would occur, then why worry about it? What is born is destined to die. What dies will be born again, will be reborn. So do not worry, do not grieve over your kinsmen who are there on this battlefield, because you are a Kshatriya. You have to do your duty. You have to fight. And Krishna will persuade Arjun to fight. He will talk about the rewards of fighting, that is 31 to 38, and even tell him the consequences of not fighting. He will appeal to him from a worldly sense. He will say that you are a Kshatriya. If you don't fight, what would the other generals say? If you leave the battlefield, they will say you are a coward. That is not befitting a warrior. You are a warrior. You need to do your duty. So Krishna leaves no stone unturned to convince Arjun to go and fight. That brings us to about halfway through the chapter. And these key verses, 211 to 230, and 10 verses that follow after that, is described as Sankhya Yoga, where he's talking about the difference between body and soul. But then from 239 to 253, another 15 verses or so, Krishna will change gears and shift to the topic of Buddhi Yoga, Nishkama Karma Yoga, where he will talk about doing one's duty, prescribed duty, without attachment to results, working in Krishna consciousness for the satisfaction of the Lord. In Prabhupada's purports, he points out that this has a transcendental quality to the work that is done. One is doing the work without consideration to gain or loss, victory or defeat, pain or pleasure, none of those opposites or duality. So that will take us up to about 53. And then from 54 to 72, in response to a question that Arjun will ask, then tell me, what are these qualities of this transcendental person, transcendental soul? Krishna will outline them. He will describe the symptoms of a person who is fixed in transcendental consciousness, a dhira soul, a steady soul, where essentially the point he will make is that this soul is one who has controlled his mind, body, and material activities, and with steady intelligence has become focused on the self, on the self, the soul, and its relationship to the super soul. So in a sense, it's focused on the supreme. But he realizes the concept of himself being this spirit soul which is its true identity, that it needs to get situated in that to focus on that. This is a broad summary. There are specific verses that are important, and I will go through some observations I've made, and we can then take up some feedback from you. So specific verses in 2.2 is a detailed purport on the definition of Bhagavan, which is one of the features of the absolute truth, the supreme entity. Is in three forms. It is in the form of Brahman, Brahmajyoti, the light coming from the body of God, Paramatma, the localized presence of the Lord in every living entity's heart, and Bhagwan, the supreme feature of Godhead, who is in his abode. So that definition is there. Then an important verse in the cluster of verses on the soul is 2.13, and we should look at that. 2.13, that is this body is just changing, the living entity just changing dress or garments. So that is the Dehino smin yatha dehe kaumaran ram yovanam jara tatha dehantara praptir tirastatra na muyati. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So what it is, the analogy here that is given is just as a person changes garments or dress every day, in the same way, the spirit soul is transmigrating from one body to another. That the bodies that it acquires within one lifetime, it has a body that's youthful, then that body becomes the body of an adult, then it becomes the body of an old man, and that body then perishes or dies. During that lifetime, that changing of these bodies is compared to just changing dress. And then when it transmigrates from one body to another at death, from birth to birth, it is the same thing. This is an important verse about the soul. Another one is 239 that defines Buddhi Yoga. And in the purport, Prabhupada explains in detail the preceding verses that Krishna has talked about the nature of the body and the soul, Samkhya Yoga. And now he's going to talk about Buddhi Yoga. And he goes into that. And relevant to this are some other verses like 261, where also you will come across the definition of Buddhi Yoga that is significant so far as this verse is concerned. So reading the purport of this is important. Then there is a set of verses, a group of verses, that refer to the Vedas and these karmakanda activities that are recommended in the Vedas. This is 242 to 46. And there, the point that is being made is this, that those living entities who are not in Krishna consciousness, they can live in the material world. They can do their duties in a regulated fashion as prescribed by the Vedas. But a person in Krishna consciousness as such does not really need these flowery words of the Vedas, these activities, because by focusing on Krishna, doing one's work without attachment to results and at the same time thinking about Krishna, itself takes care of the Vedic recommendations that are carried out. One of the analogies that is given is where you have a small well near a large body of water, a reservoir. In the same way, the spirit soul in itself is full of happiness, bliss, and eternity, that it doesn't need regulations of the Vedas for it to seek that happiness. So he tells Arjun, and one of the key verses that we can go to is 246. Well, 245 before we go to 246, where he tells Arjun that the Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjun, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self. The reference to the self, of course, is not the mind or the body. It is the higher self, which Krishna has outlined. That is the soul. Become situated in that. This is a recurring theme that will come over and over again. Then 247, perform your duty without incurring reactions to work. This is the Nishkama Karma principle. Then after this, if one follows all of this, then one acquires certain qualities. So 55 to 57 talks about qualities of a person who becomes fixed in this consciousness, samadhi, if you will, a dhira soul, one, a steady sage, if you will. What exactly he's doing, he's refraining from sense gratification, he's controlling his mind, body, etc., and focusing his consciousness onto Krishna. He does work. It's not that he's refraining from work, but he's not undergoing reactions to work. He's working, but he's not attached to the results, and his consciousness is focused on the Supreme. That is a steady soul. This way, when one seizes sense enjoyment, one can experience a higher taste. In those verses, the point is made that if you directly go to control sense gratification, it's very difficult. But if you take on to devotional service, which is a higher taste, it will automatically take care of this sense gratification. Okay, this verse is recommended to be memorized. This is 259. This is the Vishaya Vinivartante Niraharasya Dehina Rasa Varjam Raso Api Asya Param Drishtva Nivartate. That is recommended to be memorized. And 213 that we did, that verse is also recommended to be memorized. And then 261 is important because it comes back to this Buddhi Yoga principle. Person who perfectly controls his senses in samadhi. The first time in Gita that the Lord asserts himself there. And then we should also pay attention to 262 and 63 because there is the dynamics of how senses get involved with sense objects, then what happens from there on. So it talks about, while contemplating the objects of the senses, 262, a person develops attachment for them. From that attachment, lust develops, and from lust, anger arises. And the next verse, it's not memorizing. This is just to know the principle, just to know the principle of, if they were to ask how does one fall down in the process of sense gratification, this is the sequence. Attachment to sense objects, then that is leading to lust. Lust leads to anger. Anger to delusion, bewilderment to memory, and a person falls down. So those are the dynamics of involvement of senses with sense objects. And these are some of the pointers I had on this. Open to comments.
So Keshwari Mataji, you can tell the list of possible questions that can come from this chapter.
Hare Krishna. I thought I should send out an email with the probable questions. I mean, this is not probable questions. I thought that in the second chapter there are so many important Sanskrit words that it would be helpful for us to remember, especially for preaching. Suppose somebody asks for something, then we can, it'll be helpful for everybody. So,
sure. Would you like to point out some?
Yes. I was thinking about Shafras. I was thinking about Aryan in text 2. So I thought it would be good for us to know what Aryan is. And coming over to how the body reacts, you know, how there's birth, that it stays for some time, it grows, it dwindles and perishes. So it's very nice to remember the soul exactly opposite. Because even though we don't remember, like, it's immutable, it's insoluble, even if we're not able to remember those words in the test in case it comes in, but it's easy to describe it exactly opposite. So because there's no birth for the soul, it stays eternally, it doesn't stay for some time. It cannot, it doesn't grow, it's unchangeable, it doesn't dwindle, so it doesn't die, it doesn't perish, and it's eternal. So I was thinking that would be a good thing to remember. And in text 17, there are five kinds of heirs, which is page 84. So it'll be nice for us to remember the prana, vyana, samana, udana. I thought those are the five heirs in which the soul stays. And I will send the email out.
Okay.
So kutastha is also a study. That is in text 20. What does kutastha mean? But there are so many more words, especially in the second chapter, that... even though it's not just for exam, it is nice to know, just because when we finish the chapter and suddenly they ask the Sanskrit word of that, and then it's nice to remember. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. Any other observations or comments on this? This is actually a very important chapter because the whole of Gita is summarized here. Description of the soul, all the verses on the soul are here. Sankhya Yoga is here. Introduction to Buddhi Yoga is here. Srila Prabhupada does point out that it is not a systematic discussion in second chapter. That will come later, but the introductions are there. The seeds are planted. And this person with steadiness, steady intelligence, who is restrained from sense gratification, is over here. Because Arjun will refer back to this, that you said this, so why now are you asking me to fight and things like that. Those references will be to things that Krishna has said in the second chapter. Yeah.
I think important was defeating the philosophy of Mayavadi on the basis of some verses. Never there was a time when I did not exist,
yes.
Nor you and nor all the kings. Nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So I think Prabhupada has defeated that Mayavadi philosophy, or something to note about. I think that was one thing. And another thing is, I think Krishna also explains Arjun from the perspective of a philosophy where they don't consider soul to be eternal. So that aspect is also covered by Krishna. I think Prabhupada terms those as Vaibhasika philosophy,
yes.
Lokayatiska, or Buddhist philosophy. So he has covered that angle also.
What's the person number?
Verse number, I don't know. I think that's it. I think size of the soul and all that thing is, I think everybody knows that. Yeah.
It's verse 226.
226. Yeah, Shukeshwari, you had something?
I'm not too sure if you have time. I just had one question actually for Shivas Pandit Prabhu. In the page 85, can I go over it, Rakshit Prabhu? Really?
Yeah,
quick?
Sure.
Okay. It's actually 217. But the end of the purport is true. It's on the page 85. Similarly, the fragmental parts of the Supreme Lord are atomic sparks of the rays of the Supreme Lord, called the name Prabha or superior energy. So, does it mean that the souls are actually... Did you get it, Prabhu? 85. Oh, sorry. Okay, let me tell you. This is the end of the purport of 217. Yeah, it's the last paragraph. It says, such atomic particles of the spirit whole are compared to the sunshine molecules. In the sunshine, there are innumerable radiant molecules. Similarly, the fragmental parts of the Supreme Lord are atomic sparks of the rays of the Supreme Lord, called the name Prabha or superior energy. So whether one follows Vedic knowledge or modern science, one cannot deny the existence of spirit soul in the body. My question here is, Prabhuji, that I understand that when, people who believe that Brahman is the ultimate, feel that in the rays, they go and merge into the rays of Brahman and they stay there. But Prabhupada is here, he's telling that we are the parts in the rays. So I was a little confused about that. We are a part of Krishna, but we have an individual...
Here, similarly, the fragmental parts of the Supreme are called atomic sparks of the rays of the Supreme Lord, called the name Prabha. Here, lights are made up of photons, which are distinct particles. But when all the photons join together, it's as if there is a ray of a light. So, the atomic part is that individual small part. And they are part of, like, the rays is this, the ray of the Lord. So, for example, when we say ray, means to say one straight line from the source of the light to the place where light is falling. But here it's a little bit more different. The atomic soul is the rays of the Lord having many, many atomic souls in that one particular ray. Is that?
I was just thinking, Prabhuji, that when a person gets liberated, the soul of the person actually gets into the planet of, the one of the Vaikuntha planets and serves Krishna. So, but people who are in the Brahman realization, they go and become a part of the ray, right? So in that context, how do we...
They merge. There are, as we know in Bhagavatam, there are five kinds of liberation. And one is merging into the body of the Lord. That is, the Brahman effulgence is Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasyapi Tamukam. So the effulgence of the Lord is their soul merges into the effulgence of the Lord. Now, it's again, the physics is not directly linking up or correlating physics with the spiritual science. In physics, Prabhupada is using this as a simile to kind of tell that, you know, we are that light, individual very small light particle which forms the rays coming from the Lord is what we are. So it's not exactly like light phenomena that happens here. A little bit help? Okay.
And also each living entity would be that small particle. It's not that the living entity itself then is divided into subparticle. It's a reference to us being that spark, that little fragment, because we are an atomic soul. Okay. Yes. One last question on chapter 2.
What's the Buddhi Yoga, Prabhuji?
Buddhi Yoga is working in Krishna consciousness. One is working without attachment to results or to fruitive activity, and at the same time, one's consciousness is actually focused on Krishna. That one is working for the satisfaction of the Lord rather than for sense gratification. So you have these karmis who are working, okay? But, and they may be doing their prescribed duty also, but they may be working for sense gratification, some material benefit. One of the features here is that... The person in Buddhi Yoga is using that spiritual intelligence to refrain from material engagement, carrying out the duty. One has to carry out one's duty for purification purposes. It's not recommended to directly take to the path of renunciation. So one has to work for the sake of purification, but one is not working for a material benefit or a fruitive activity. One is really working for the Lord, for the satisfaction of the Lord. One is working in Krishna consciousness, where the consciousness is focused on Krishna. That's what I understand.
I think we'll take that's the last thing. It's a good question, but in the next chapter next semester we'll go more into it. But just to give a quick glimpse, if you can open page 460, that is just, it's a 10th chapter and 10th verse. Yes. The translation is, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, the word Buddhi Yoga or Buddhi Yogam is very significant. We may remember that in the second chapter, the Lord instructing Arjuna said that He had spoken to him of many things and that He would instruct him in the way of Buddhi Yoga. Now Buddhi Yoga is explained. Buddhi Yoga itself is action in Krishna consciousness, that is the highest intelligence. Buddhi means intelligence and yoga means mystic activities or mystic elevation. When one tries to go back home, back to Godhead, and takes to full Krishna consciousness in devotional service, his action is called Buddhi Yoga. In other words, Buddhi Yoga is the process by which one gets out of material entanglement of this material world. So, a little bit here, and then we'll get...
It may.
I was just going to say that was going to be one of my questions that I was going to send in email.
Yes.
Yeah, because he mentions the second chapter so many times. I thought it's just, nice to know what it means.
Yeah, it comes up in the second chapter in 239, 261. Then also in the summary, one purport of the third chapter, he refers to it. And then there is this 10:10, where there is this extended definition. Okay, so we should move on then to chapter 3, which is Karma Yoga. And this chapter starts with Arjun now inquiring and telling Krishna that you have said that intelligence is better than fruitive activity. That goes back again to the verses in the second chapter.
The fruitive activity, he never said that in the... But I think Arjun misunderstood... Arjun thought that if he fights, then it would be fruitive activity, right?
If he?
Fights, then it would be considered as fruitive activity.
Yes, that's mentioned in the purport that Arjun, when he was told about Buddhi Yoga, didn't exactly understand it, that there was no sense gratification component or fruitive activity component involved. So he thinks that by fighting, there would be a result and some fruit there. So why are you asking me to fight when you say that intelligence is the superior thing? That is essentially his question. And so Krishna in his reply in the next set of verses from 2 to 8, there is this discussion where Krishna goes into this discussion that he's not saying that work should be abstained. Because, you know, when you do work, there could be a fruit or a result. He is not recommending, he's recommending neither renunciation from work, complete renunciation, nor abstaining from it. He will say that every living entity, because of their conditioning by modes of material nature, cannot refrain from work. They cannot maintain their physical body by not working. He will go into it a little more. Then in 3:9 and 10, he will say, work is to be performed. Initially, we'll say it should be performed as a sacrifice to Lord Vishnu. That has to be done. Krishna talks about how in the beginning, living entities and demigods were sent here on earth with a lot of these recommended sacrifices for Lord Vishnu. And that if they carried them out according to prescription, they would have prosperity and happiness. So he refers to that, that work has to be performed, but it has to be a sacrifice to the Lord. Why this? Because this type of work won't bind a living entity to matter. It is free of bondage. So it is recommended. And then the purport of one of those verses, I believe it's 3.9 or 3.10, Srila Prabhupada goes into this, that the recommended sacrifice for this age is this Sankirtan Yajna. The type of yajna that can be performed is Sankirtan Yajna, where devotees are chanting the name of the Lord and also distributing the knowledge of Krishna consciousness. So then this is extended further, 3.11 and 13. Krishna will say that work done in this fashion, if these sacrifices are given to Lord Vishnu, even the demigods are pleased because they supply all the necessities of life, and so they'll be pleased. They will supply these necessities. And those who knows that the necessities are coming from the demigod will be grateful for that. If food grains or other things that are given to them, they will first offer it to the Lord before eating it. Whereas those who are not grateful will take these gifts that the demigods are giving, including food, without offering to the demigod. They are thieves. They are invariably committing sin. and then there is this key verse, 3.14, which talks about the sequence where everything is coming from. Living entities are sustaining on food grains that's coming from rains. Rains are coming from performance of yajna, sacrifice. And yajna is actually coming from your carrying out your prescribed duties that you are obligated to, where you would be doing it here in a regulated way or without attachment. And then there is a reference that in the Vedas, 3.15, regulated activities are prescribed. Because the Vedas come from the Supreme Lord, there is a certain transcendence in there. So when you do sacrifice, it has a transcendence feature in it. It's not just a mundane activity. What about one who doesn't perform sacrifice? Well, he's leading a life of sin. This life of sense gratification is a life of sin. It is living in vain, that talks about in 3.16. And then 3.17 and 19, it comes back to this person who is following these principles that have been talked about. One who is in fully consciousness is an individual who is satisfied in the self. And Krishna will also say that such a person actually doesn't have any duty to perform or any reason not to perform them. But he is still advised to act, to do his duty on behalf of Krishna, to work without attachment, because if he works that way, he will attain Krishna. That is one. Second, he'll be setting an example for other living entities to work in that fashion. So once again, Krishna makes the point, he is not recommending abstaining from work or renunciation from work, but performing work without attachment. So he says that in performing your work, you are educating the public. He gives example, a king, Janaka, who was a king, had everything. He attained perfection this way in his actions. He worked for the common men, and they saw greatness in a great person like this. And there is one verse that says, what great people do, common men will follow. So this type of work is exemplary. It does set an example. Then further moving on, text 22 to 24, Krishna talks about himself. He says, for me there is no duty that is prescribed. Yet he is engaged in taking care of the universes and the world. Because if he failed to do so, people will follow his example that he's not working. And what's the consequence? That the worlds will be ruined, there will be unwanted population, and the peace of living beings would be destroyed. So the cluster of verses 322 to 24 point that out. Then Krishna talks about ignorant and learned men, 325 to 29. He says these ignorant men work with attachment to result, thinking themselves to be the doer, when actually the modes of material nature are doing things. And learned men work without attachment to results. They are working in devotion. For leading people on the right path, they are setting that example. But at the same time, he says, learned men should not induce ignorant men to stop work, but they should gradually bring them to Krishna consciousness. Gradually act in a way, show how the results of activities can be dedicated to the service of Krishna. Don't disturb them, but at the same time, show them in a gradual way, bring them to Krishna consciousness. 330 is a key verse. There Krishna gives the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita. He tells Arjun to surrender all work to him and work in full knowledge of him without desires for profit or claims to proprietorship and free of lethargy. And he said, in the process, you should fight, carry out your duty that you are a kshatriya. So that is 330. Therefore, O Arjun, surrender all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desires for profit, with no claims for proprietorship, and free from lethargy. Fight. One should read the purport of this verse in detail because it has a very good explanation. Moving on further, in 31 and 32, Krishna says that those who work this way, who carry out their duties according to his injunctions without envy, will attain liberation. They'll be free from this bondage of karma, free from reactions, free from material entanglement. But those who disregard them out of envy won't find perfection, won't find liberation. They will be ruined on their path. Now, he does say, it is granted that everyone will act according to their own nature, because the three modes of material, the three modes of nature, have a conditioning influence on the soul. So one should not give up one's occupational duties instantly. But being Krishna conscious, one can continue doing the duties, follow the rules and regulations from the scriptures, and one would become slowly detached from them in their path or in their progress. And 335, which is the final verse, I believe. No, actually, it's not the final verse. 335 is a significant verse where Krishna is pointing out that it's better for a living entity to perform, discharge one's own prescribed duties, even if they are faulty, and not to copy somebody else. Destruction in the course of performing one's own duty is better than engaging in another's duty, for to follow another's path is dangerous. So that is 335. Then the next set of four verses, Krishna will point out essentially in response, I believe, to... Does Arjun ask a question? Yes. Yeah, Arjun asks a question in 336. What is one impelled? What is it that impels one to sinful acts, even if unwillingly by force? And Krishna will say, it is really lust. And then he goes into the dynamics of all of that, that the lust is sitting in the mind, in the senses, everywhere. So he will tell Arjun know this, it is the enemy of a living entity. Curb this lust. Slay it with knowledge and self-realization by regulating the senses. 338 to 41. Then Krishna will end the chapter by pointing out a gradient where he will say that the working senses, although superior to matter, are actually lower than the mind. The mind itself is lower than intelligence, and intelligence is lower than the soul. The soul is the highest. And so what's coming from the soul, spiritual intelligence, is the true intelligence, the key. And so in the final verse, which is the important verse of this chapter, chapter ends, Krishna will tell Arjun, knowing yourself to be higher than senses, mind, and intelligence, conquer this lust, this enemy, by steadying the mind through this spiritual intelligence, which is really coming from the soul. That's where you will get this spiritual strength that can be directed towards the true identity of the self. The previous reference to get situated in the self is that beware of the concept of the self, that you are the self, the higher self, which has the spiritual intelligence. Use that to steady the mind and control this senses. And that way you will find perfection. So that's how this chapter ends. And I have pointed out some key verses as we have gone along. We can take some comments from you if you thought anything else to be significant here.
I just thought it will be very nice. I mean, it was very nice purport in text 31 where it was very apt for me, so I wanted to share that. But an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness.
Oh yes, I thought that was a good purport also, because the explanation is very good in that. So that should be marked for further reading. Anything else on?
There were same Sanskrit verses. Mm-hmm. One was Acharya in text 21. Who is an Acharya?
Mm-hmm.
And there was the karma vikarma thing in the
yes.
text 15, which might be important. And what is a santa? That is in text 13. Yeah. And what is Maitunya Agara in text 39? And what is Swarthagati in text 7? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Some of this will also come up in chapter 5, which is action in Krishna consciousness, also Karma Yoga. And when we get to that, there would be some references. So if no more further feedback on chapter 3, we should move on to chapter 2. Gandharika Mataji, or chapter 4, sorry. Not going backwards, but going forward. Chapter 4, and Gandharika Mataji will talk about that.
Well, excellent work, Rakshit Prabhu.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
yes, Srivansh Prabhu, in fact, was saying that...
We can upload it to the Yahoo groups, or we can...
Okay. Do I have? Yes, I do. Soft copy? Yes, I do. In fact, I can pull it. No, I can pull it out. I can pull that out. Because on this one, of course, it's going to be. Let's see. No, I have it. I have. No, this is okay. This is just an approach. Yeah, go ahead while we are getting this set up. So this is about transcendental knowledge. You'll just have to scroll through. You'll be able to read it.
Yeah.
Okay. So in normally he says I, me, I mean he refers to himself, but in 9 and 10 he says his satisfaction, or he says the Lord created all creatures. I mean, why does he say like that? He is the one, right? Krishna in text 9, for instance, he says, therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duties for his satisfaction. Like that. I mean, why should he put it in third person in those two verses?
I think we find in Bhagavad Gita this type of a situation at other places also. And it is, my impression on that is, it's just a translation. It's not that Krishna is referring to another he, you know, for his satisfaction. His satisfaction is himself. So it should be me. That's what you're saying. Why is it not me? But we find in the Bhagavad Gita at other places also there is this reference.
Well, Krishna, when we talk of Krishna, Krishna is not just himself. He is unlimited. And part of his unlimited form is Vishnu. Dipar Chirevahi Dashantaram Apyupetya Dipayati Vivutahetu. So we learn in Brahma Samhita. So when he refers to Lord Vishnu, offering sacrifice to Lord Vishnu, or whether he says me, it doesn't make a difference. Here, in this verses, here he refers specifically to Lord Vishnu, who is the maintainer of this particular universe. So in that sense, sometimes he tells about himself, sometimes he... And even in Bhagavad Gita, we have many places where Krishna says, this is the opinion of the learned scholars. This is my opinion. It doesn't make any difference. It's just because his opinion is the ultimate opinion. So, nothing much to be read into.
I was thinking it is also the language, because like in Tamil and Malayalam, when you say it, people that, can you give it to me? You sometimes tell that person's name. Like for example, if you're telling the kid, can you give it to me? You say, can you give it to Amma? Like, you know, I'm Amma, but you tell, can you give it to me? So even in Malayalam, it's like that. You tell, can you give it to Madhavi? Then actually Madhavi is the one who's speaking. But then I was just thinking in that context that it could be the Sanskrit text that is just directly translated in that language. And
when you say, can you give it to Amma, can you give it to her, means to a third person, not to yourself, right?
Is
it's so that in the third chapter he's not asserting himself. Still he's saying okay, but he will. I mean, but not asserting like consistently.
ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलकाय चक्षुषोरोन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमः ओं विष्णुपादाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्तस्वामीति नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वतीदेवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे ओं नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So what we are doing here is we are just we have a course called Bhakti Shastri where some students have taken the course and we are reviewing the first 9 chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So today is kind of a practical demonstration session. So I am a student and Shivas Pandit Prabhu is a teacher. So
that student.
No. So I'm just going to give a brief introduction to chapter 4 and I'll try my best because I came to know last night and I think please tolerate and to my ability whatever I have understood I'll just share and if there are any clarifications we can ask our teacher. So this chapter is called Transcendental Knowledge. Transcendental Knowledge, Krishna exemplifies the importance of knowledge and he also establishes the history of Bhagavad Gita just to show like how it is authentic and when it came into place and all that. I'm just going to use the summaries that are provided in the class. And as an overview, and then we'll go deep into each verse. So the first verse talks about the history of Gita. Krishna himself opens up the chapter, saying that he spoke the Bhagavad Gita to the sun god Vivaswan, and Vivaswan spoke it to Manu, and Manu spoke it to Ikshvaku. So why these kings are important and why Prabhupada mentions that Manu, Ikshvaku and Vivaswan and all that is very vividly explained in the purport saying that the sun god is the king of all planets and that provides the energy for all the planetary systems and we also live in one of those planets and from sun, the earth, the Ikshvaku is the king of the earth. So Prabhupada exemplifies how it is very important for each and every administrative ruler to understand the essence of Bhagavad Gita because he has to give it to his citizens. So Prabhupada gives a rough estimation more scientifically saying that Bhagavad Gita is there on this earth planet for almost like 2 million years and it has been in existence in this cosmic creation for almost kind of 120,400,000 years which is like unimaginable. So nobody can say that Bhagavad Gita was just created or spoken by some Krishna who's like an imaginary person or something. So Prabhupada opens up the chapter like that and then he goes to the second one saying that how people misinterpret Bhagavad Gita. Like Krishna is such a great personality, there are some people who say that, who take Bhagavad Gita and then they distort it and they present it in their own way. So Prabhupada in this purport clearly explains the why, what is the importance of Bhagavad Gita as it is. So he says that everyone should understand Bhagavad Gita in the disciplic succession, like one who knows who Krishna is and not from the demons who just write purports on Bhagavad Gita just for making some money, to sell some books and all that. So that is a very important point in this purport. And then Prabhupada goes on to the, in the second verse, the key thing, Prabhupada also says that the succession was broken. So, okay, then one person says it has been there for 2 million years, then why should you say the same thing again? Because then Prabhupada explains that because the succession was broken. And then Prabhupada goes forward in the third purport, he says that who can understand Bhagavad Gita? Because in the translation, Krishna says that my devotees, why Krishna is saying, I am speaking this to you, why not to other persons who were the millions of souls in the universe, but why is he speaking to Arjuna? Because he is a friend and he is a devotee. He is a devotee and he is a friend. So if we are envious, then there is no, we are unable to digest the mercy. So Prabhupada says that these are the qualifications to understand the Krishna, understand what Krishna is saying, and people who are envious, they cannot understand Bhagavad Gita. And then, first time, then Arjuna asks this question to Bhagavan, saying that because Arjuna knows Krishna because he has been with Krishna in many lives, and there is a very great story of explaining how even a hair in the body of Arjuna chants Krishna's names. A hair that is fallen from the body of Arjuna, if you put it on the ear, it will be saying Krishna's name. So Krishna knows Arjuna so much, but still he is asking, how am I to understand that you told this Gita to someone else and who have born like many years before you? So then why Prabhupada exemplifies, this is the way in which understanding Bhagavad Gita, because if anybody writes the purport, if they don't know Krishna, they will not touch these main points of the intimacy and why is this question like that. So Prabhupada exemplifies saying that he is asking because he wants us to know. He wants the world, Arjuna wants the world to know how the supreme position of Krishna. So he is asking that question to Arjuna. And then one sentence that Prabhupada makes in the purport is, when Lord speaks about himself, it is the most auspiciousness for all the living entities. So Arjuna wanted to start that about his glories and why he is coming and all that, so that he himself can exemplify. So that is the main point in the fourth verse. And then Lord Krishna explains how Arjuna and Lord has taken many births, but Krishna remembers all that, but Arjuna forgets because though devotees are at the level of the Lord, in this verse it's really proven that how the living entities are still parts and parcels. So no matter how much ever exalted position one can attain, we can never equal the Lord and remember all that has happened in our life since time immemorial. So that is explained in the fifth verse of Bhagavad Gita. And then still we are in the same chapter, Krishna, same topic of Krishna is explaining how, why he appears and how he appears and the supremacy. And here Krishna is saying that when he comes, he explains an important term called Atma Maya in this verse, sixth. He says this, when he comes out of his own internal potency. So we are conditioned by our karma and then we take birth. But when Lord comes, he just comes by himself. And very importantly, Prabhupada explains this in Vishwakosha dictionary. Prabhupada translates Atma Maya as Lord's causeless mercy. It means Lord's causeless mercy, he appears. So that, let me just go there in that. Really caught my attention. So he says the word Maya or Atma Maya refers to the Lord's causeless mercy according to the Vishwakosha dictionary. So that's really interesting. And he says that how Prabhupada explains how astonishingly Krishna never grows beyond, like we never see him with the beard and all that. So Prabhupada explains how the supremacy, supreme position of Krishna in a very nice way in that purport. Now, the in the seventh verse, I lost it.
Scroll from the, from there.
Sorry. So in this verse, in seventh verse, is Krishna is telling when he will appear. So why? So now he established how he appears through his internal potency. Now he is explaining when he will appear. He will appear when there is a decline in religion and rise in irreligion. So and then he explains, again Prabhupada explains, like he manifests himself, and then he says the word Srijami. And then he also explains very vividly that avatara, because Prabhupada wants to clearly explain that nobody else can claim that he is an avatara. So Prabhupada says like how it is mentioned in the scriptures, and the time is mentioned, place is mentioned, and all that is mentioned. So Prabhupada is establishing that it's not nobody else can claim that he is Krishna. And then he can say that he appeared to establish religion and all. So that is a very nice purport. And Prabhupada also makes it clear in this purport that sometimes he comes directly and sometimes he also sends his servants. So he establishes the glory of the acharyas in that purport, saying that sometimes Krishna himself sends the acharyas. And then Prabhupada makes a very nice point, saying that the main essence of all of Krishna's, this one is to take people, to make them obedient to the religion and take them to the point of Krishna consciousness. That is the underlying principle of Krishna's birth. And then we are still on the same topic of when and why Krishna appears. And then here Prabhupada is explaining in the 8th verse about the primary and the secondary purposes of Lord's descent. And here, if we read any other Bhagavad Gita, nobody will even talk about how this verse applies to today's age. Like, I don't see Krishna today. But Prabhupada is so nicely explaining that, first of all, logically, if God is so much and just by glancing he is creating all this, impregnating this material nature with souls, he is so much powerful, why would he even appear to kill those people who are acting demoniacally? So it sounds illogical. So Krishna explains how he appears to mitigate the anxieties of his dear devotees and exchange loving relationships with them. He comes himself. So he establishes that in that purport. And then Prabhupada clearly says that because in the previous verse it is said that in every millennium Krishna appears. So please you also understand that in this millennium also he is there as Lord Chaitanya. Spreading this Lord Chaitanya Sankirtana movement. So that is a very important and a clear, one can get a clear understanding from every purport of Prabhupada's book, whatever he's writing, because he is really bringing it to today, what you can do about it today. So what you can do about it today is take part in the Sankirtana movement, because the incarnation is still there now. And then Prabhupada goes to the 9th verse. I remember this because we read this on the Janmashtami day. Vaisheshika Prabhu was pointing this to prove that how if by understanding the birth and the activities of Krishna, one can become liberated from the material sufferings. So here the very important term that the impersonalist uses, Tattvamasi, is very vividly explained here. And Prabhupada says that if one can, means if one goes in front of Krishna and says that you're that supreme person, just seeing Krishna, then one gets liberated. You are not that supreme person. You acknowledge in front of the deity that you are that supreme person, Tattvamasi, then one gets liberated. Prabhupada uses the word instantly. So that is something to note. Prabhupada says if one says that, one is liberated instantly. And then that's a very nice purport. Then let's go to the next one. Where so now Krishna is saying all the ways in which whatever is said in the Vedas and how one can attain this transcendental knowledge and what are the different ways and all that. So in the 10th verse he's starting with the explaining that there are three stages of material life. How so first of all, one is very, very negligent. We don't want to do anything. That's first stage. And another stage is even if we want to do little bit, we are like fear of taking responsibility because we don't want to think ourselves as individuals. Because when we think ourselves as individuals, then we talk about we want to take responsibility for our action. So there is a fear of taking that position of individuals. And then even if people take and follow that, then they come to a conclusion that there is nothing. But there is an argument saying that the nothing is really foolishness, Prabhupada says. Because even if we think in the beginning there is nothing, in the end there is nothing, but in between two nothings, how can be there is something? So this nothingness is logically, it's nothing. Because we are actually existing since time immemorial. So that is something to be noted. And Prabhupada very nicely explains how the six stages of purification, how one, from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, saying that how when we start with desire and then we get association. And then from association we get initiation and we start executing and then we get taste for devotional service and then prema, bhava, all that stages Prabhupada explains. So Prabhupada says that we have to get rid of all these three stages of material life simply by taking to Krishna consciousness. And then in the 11th verse, Krishna just says that whatever you are suffering, because you cannot blame it on me, because however you reciprocate with, I reward accordingly. Because sometimes people may say that I have been worshipping you, like nothing is happening. Those are all like blind words, because Krishna is clearly saying that like just like a desire tree, like whatever you desire, it will give. It doesn't mean that the desire tree cannot give anything more than that. It is on the responsibility is upon us. So Krishna is well establishing the fact, saying that I reward the souls according to their surrender. And then in the 12th verse, Prabhupada is clearly establishing, saying that why would anyone go to the demigods? Because we are all interested in fruitive activities. That is why we start worshipping the demigods. And in the remaining verses, Krishna clearly establishes himself that how he is not to do with anything that he has created. Like how the government creates the prison house, like maybe the president or someone who may create a prison house within this world, but he has nothing to do with what is happening within the prison house. But his only goal is to make sure that the prisoners who are in that prison house realize their mistakes and get out of that prison house. So that is what he is explaining in the remaining verses. So in the 13th verse, he is explaining that first I created this four kinds of Varnashrama, Brahmanas, Vaishyas, Shudras and Kshatriyas. I created, depending upon your nature that you acquired by your association with the material modes. But he is still yet the non-doer. Because he created the Varnashrama Dharma, but the purpose is to realize Krishna consciousness. That is the goal, but it in a systematic way. And then the second was also Prabhupada explains like how he stays aloof from the material creation. In the 15th verse, Prabhupada very clearly makes a very nice point, especially for all of us, saying that Prabhupada uses this word, foolish. Persons who are foolish will tend to retire from the prescribed duties, because Prabhupada is saying that one cannot prematurely retire from prescribed duties. Like, because as Kshatriyas, one may have lots of prescribed duties. As Brahmanas and Vaishyas, they may have prescribed duties. What Prabhupada is saying, unless your desire for sense gratification is given up, if you really give up your prescribed duties and you want to stay in one place and chant Hare Krishna, that is, Prabhupada is calling it as foolishness. And only people who are foolish will tend to do that. But usually, I also, when beginners in Krishna consciousness, we tend to think that, oh, why should I do all that and work for all people and maintain those relationships and take care of the relatives and take care of the friends, attend this program, that function, like that. But Prabhupada says that you have to remain there. Unless your Krishna consciousness goes to a mature state, you cannot prematurely give up Krishna consciousness. So that is a very important point in the 15th purport. So, and then in the 16th verse, the main point that Prabhupada makes is one should follow in the footsteps of Mahajans. Because even in this world, everybody wants to, like, if anybody is very successful, we want to read the book written by him, right? Like Stephen Covey and whatever. We read that, how they attained that stage. So we want to know that. So that is what is mentioned in the Shastra. Mahajanoyena Gata Sampanta means follow in the footsteps of the Mahajans. So Prabhupada, because they have gone through all this and you can learn how to pass through this. So that is the main thing Prabhupada is saying here. Otherwise, it's very bewildering if we don't follow in their path. In the 17th and 18th verse is Prabhupada is talking about the different kinds of actions. And first of all, one should have the knowledge to understand what is action and what is not, what it means inaction. So he is telling about like three kinds of things. Karma. Karma is like what we do, like whatever is laid down. I do good, I get good. I do bad, and then I get bad. Vikarma is I just go beyond whatever is said in the Shastras. I act whimsically. I don't follow the rules. I just do whatever I think is the best for the destruction. Maybe if I am demoniac, then I just execute my demoniac principles, not following the injunctions. So that is not good. And karma is like it's still binding. Either you are shackled in golden shackles or by doing good activities, or you are shackled in iron shackles by doing bad activities, but you are still shackled. So Prabhupada says that you should go beyond this by doing Krishna consciousness, which brings neither good nor bad. It is transcendental and it is pleasing to the Lord. So Prabhupada explains that, and he is saying that you have to act in Krishna consciousness. That is more important than simply sitting and meditating. Because inaction is actually illogical. Because one in the previous chapters, Prabhupada said, like even for a minute, one moment, one cannot stop doing activity. So that is important. And then in the remaining verses, considering the time, I'm just trying to cover. So in the 19th to 22nd verse, Prabhupada is saying that what is the type of a spiritualist? Like how does he? What are his symptoms that? Why does he not accumulate spiritual, like sinful reactions? Why does it not come to him? So Prabhupada really explains that he doesn't have any sense gratification, desire for sense gratification. He is not attached to the results of what he is doing. He doesn't think that I am the proprietor of whatever I do. So he just acts for the bare necessities of his life. So all those qualities are exemplified in Prabhupada's purports in all those verses. And one main important verse is Yadrichaya that Vaisheshika Prabhu always explains. Like he just accepts whatever comes on its own accord. He doesn't do anything like more, endeavors for anything. So that is exemplified. In the next verses, Prabhupada is explaining like how everything is spiritualized by acting in Krishna consciousness. Means if one is fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, whatever he does, it is spiritualized. And that is the only way to gain the real knowledge. And then Prabhupada goes on to say the different types of sacrifices, like how one sacrifices the material things and how one might sacrifice. There are so many sacrifices mentioned in the Shastras. Prabhupada says that irrespective of whatever sacrifices you do, if there is no spiritual realizations, it's a waste of time. So that is what is Prabhupada mainly exemplifying. And then Prabhupada is saying that if you don't do sacrifice, there is no happiness, because the purpose of human life is for sacrifice. It's really bewildering to know that why is sacrifice so much given, like why should I do austerities and all that. But here it is said that sacrifice is what is the duty of a soul, like one should do that. And if we don't do that, we cannot be happy in this life nor in the next. And then comes a very important purport. Prabhupada, so far Krishna explained like what is the, how he came and what are the qualities of the spiritualist and how, like when he appears and all that, and how knowledge is important. Now he is saying how can we get that knowledge. So he is showing the way. He says, Tadviti Pranipatena. He says that one should approach a guru. And by humbly serving him, one can get the knowledge by following in his footsteps. And then why is he suggesting that? Is because if we do that, then we can attain peace. Because if all the time we are looking for peace and happiness. So Prabhupada is giving the explanation for happiness. And if we don't, if we just disregard all that and just act on our own way, whimsically, then Prabhupada says you will fall down. So you will never attain peace. You will be bewildered. So, and then in the last verse, Prabhupada explains gives a summary of the entire chapter, and he makes a very important point how by knowledge one can destroy ignorance. Because if you have heard Vaisheshika Prabhu's presentation that he gave on the other day, he put Krishna on the top and he started with the word ignorance. Ignorance, he split it into ignore. He started from the word ignore. Ignore means you ignored the Lord, and then that started all your fall down and your suffering now. But you're gaining knowledge about who I am, who is Krishna, and how can I put an end to all my suffering. By reading Bhagavad Gita, if we understand the transcendental knowledge, we can be really happy. So knowledge is very important, and it burns all the sinful reactions. That's what Prabhupada is saying. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Gandharvika Mataji. Very nice presentation.
We may point out here for the Bhakti Shastri students that verse 4.9 is suggested to be memorized in this chapter. Some of the other things are, what is karma, akarma, vikarma, why does the Lord incarnate, and the different avatars of the Lord are some of the pointers here.
I was just quickly going to go over it's Apurusheya in text 1. And the avatara and the five different kinds of avataras in the text 8. Om Agyanan Timrandesya Agyananjana Shalakya Chakshurun Meditam Yena Tismay Shri Gurve Namaha Vamsha Kalpadarupyascha Kripasandupyevacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. I'm going to do the chapter 5. In the first text, actually, I probably wouldn't go text by text. I'll just go over what exactly is the scenario that's happening. Arjuna asks Krishna that what is better, renunciation or work in devotion? So that was the question raised by Arjuna. And so Krishna is answering that work in devotion is surely better. But basically both the end is going to be the same, but the work in devotion is suggested by Krishna's being better than renunciation. But he, Prabhupada explains in the purport that it's not just enough that you identify yourself as a spirit soul, but also should act as a spirit soul and feel that everything belongs to the Lord. And then it comes to text 3. He is asking that a person who is renounced neither is desiring any kind of a fruit, nor is actually hating anything. So such a kind of a person will easily be able to overcome material bondage. As it goes to text 4, where he says that devotional service and Sankhya philosophy is basically the same thing. It's like watering the tree. He uses an analogy here. Watering the tree is devotional service, and finding for the root is analytical knowledge. So in anything you apply, basically the result that you're going to achieve is the same. In text 5, he says that Sankhya is a detachment from matter, and devotional service or yoga is attachment to Krishna. So when you're detaching from matter and attaching to Krishna, basically the end result is the same. And that's the reason he considers Sankhya Yoga and Bhakti Yoga to be the same. Coming over to text 6, he says that renouncing with no devotion is not going to make anybody really happy. So only devotional service is something that will take a person, will make a person very happy. So if a person is just renouncing things and not Krishna conscious, he is not going to achieve what he really wants to achieve. In this purport, Prabhupada talks about two different kinds of sannyasis. He talks about Mayavadi sannyasis and Vaishnava sannyasis. Mayavadi sannyasis are sitting down to speculate about Brahman, and they're going to they're taking through the very long process. And Vaishnava sannyasis are basically following the Bhagavatam part, and they achieve their result really quick. But Mayavadi sannyasis also come to Krishna consciousness after many births because they're trying to reach the same thing in a very difficult way. Text 7 talks about work and devotion, where he says that pure soul is one who controls the mind and senses, and he's actually dear to everybody, and everybody is dear to him. And this such a kind of a person is never entangled. And now Krishna tells Arjuna, just fight for me. That will cause him not to be entangled ever. Coming over to text 8 and 9, he talks about the divine consciousness of a person who says that all the things that he do, like if he's smelling, he's touching, he's moving, he's sleeping, he's breathing, he does everything. He thinks that these are the material senses that are involved in this, but he as a person, as a soul, is aloof to this. And basically he is all the time trying to satisfy the sense of Krishna, so he is very happy. And the text 10, she talks about the duty. If you have to do your duty, do it without any kind of attachment, and surrender results to the Supreme. And when you do this, a person is not affected by any kind of a sinful reaction. And he talks about the analogy about the lotus leaf. A lotus leaf is not touched by water, even though it is on the water. Similarly, a person in Krishna consciousness is not touched by any kind of sin. Text 11. Here he talks about a yogi who is abandoning all kinds of attachment and acts with his sense, mind and intelligence, just dedicated to Krishna. And such a kind of a person is actually automatically gets purified from the material contamination. In text 12, Prabhupada talks about the devotee is, when he is totally devoted, offers everything to Krishna, and he attains peace. So a person who attains peace is a person who dedicates everything to Krishna, and a person who is entangled is a person who is greedy for the fruits of what he does. Text 13, a living entity, when he feels that he controls nature and, he has he renounces actions. Such a person Prabhupada is talking about the city of 9 gates here. When he thinks that when he renounces all the work and dedicates everything to Krishna, then he can live in the city of 9 gates. Even though he has this body, he's basically mentioning that even though he has this body, he's still acting as if he is liberated soul. In text 15, Prabhupada is mentioning that Jiva has a minute independence, and we are part and parcel of Krishna. Because we have minute independence, Krishna never comes between, interferes with our independence. He says, like, whatever we desire, he gives it to us because he's the Paramatma. But if a person moves around and looks at Krishna and thinks about Krishna, then he takes a special care for that person. Text 16. He talks about a person with knowledge and enlightenment he gets out of, he compares it to the analogy where he says that when the sun rises, and the night is totally gone and everywhere there's light. Similarly, the spiritual master is the person who actually drives away the nascence, drives away the ignorance from a person. So he talks about how the most important person in our lives is our spiritual master. In text 17, he talks about the intelligence, mind, and faith. If a person has his intelligence, mind, and faith fixed on the Supreme, then he has a direct road to the path of liberation. Text 18 is very important. It talks about Vidya Vinaya Sampanni, Brahmane Gavi Hastini. He talks about that the humble sage actually is a person who sees that all of them, like a Brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, or a dog eater, everybody is the same because Paramatma is present in each and every living entity. And he, of course, explains a little bit about the individual soul is one, but the super soul is present in all the living entities. So individual soul understands only one person's is in the one body and understands only that person, but super soul understands every individual soul who is present all over the world. Every individual living entity, I mean. In text 17, he talks about considering, just because a person thinks, understands the sameness of all the living entities, then he is ready to be liberated. In text 20, he talks about sthira buddhi, where he says that a person who's the same, if he gets happiness, if he's in the situation of sadness, he's basically has no much reaction to it. He thinks that whatever is happening is because of sense perception, and he is self-intelligent. And such kind of a person is not illusion. And such a kind of person knows about Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Am I too fast? Text 21. Here Prabhupada talks about he's not attracted to the material sense pleasure. A person who is Krishna conscious is not attracted to any kind of sense pleasure. He quotes about the example of Yamunacharya, where he tells that the taste of Krishna consciousness has seen to it that he has lost the interest to any kind of sense pleasure. So basically he mentions in this purport that Krishna consciousness and sense pleasure go ill together. In text 22, he talks about intelligence. Now, the most intelligent person is one who does not take part in any kind of sense pleasure because it's going to give the person misery. And because misery has a beginning, middle, and end. I mean, pleasure has a middle, beginning, and end. So he thinks that, there's no use of going for it. So, because then he gives an example of, in the purport, that even hogs actually have, sense pleasure is also available to them. Coming on to text 23, he talks about tolerating the urges of the senses is the most important thing for a person in Krishna consciousness, like the forces of desire and anger, is going to cause happiness to that person. And this is actually gives the person progress, helps in progress in the self-realization. In text 24, here he explains who is the person who attains supreme or Brahma Bhuta stage is a person who is happy and active and rejoice always within rather than looking for something outside and to enjoy through the senses. Text 25, a Krishna conscious person is actually a person who can really do a welfare to the living entities. The welfare is actually to get them back to Krishna consciousness. That's the most important welfare a person can do. So if a person is not doing that, not helping the person remember the forgetful identity, that we have forgotten, then there is no use. That's not really called the welfare to the living entity. The only welfare Prabhupada mentions in this purport is to remind everybody that we are part and parcel of Krishna and to be able to go back to Krishna, because otherwise they are going to suffer in this miserable world. Text 26, a person who is assured of liberation soon is a person who is free from anger, from material desires, who has to be self-realized, who is self-disciplined, and who is enduring for perfection even if difficulties arise. So I want to repeat this. A person who will surely get liberation is a free from anger, free from material desire, is self-realized, is self-disciplined, and who endures for perfection even amidst difficulties. So it really gets easy for the person to control senses. Just to surrender to Krishna, and the whole path is very easy. Text 27 to 28, he talks about Krishna consciousness, basically identifying oneself of a position that when a person does this, he feels Krishna in everything that a person does. You know, it might be at work, it might be at school, it might be at home, it might be at, in any scenario. So he sees that the hand of Krishna is present in all of the things. In this purport, he talks about Ashtanga Yoga. There are eight postures in which they try to gain the control over the senses. Prabhupada very clearly mentions, after detailed talking about what Ashtanga Yoga is and Niyama, all those things, he says that this is going to be very difficult in this age, and the only way that we can achieve perfection is just to do Krishna consciousness. Text 29 is Krishna, like, if you have to be conscious of Krishna, you have to think that Krishna is the ultimate beneficiary of all the sacrifices and austerities we do. You have to consider Krishna as the supreme of all planets and the demigods. We have to consider Krishna as the benefactor and the well-wisher for any of the living entity. Then the peace from the pangs of material miseries is achieved. I really want to go over the important points in the fifth chapter, the important words. The pradhana in the text 10. And I was thinking about the Yamanacharya's quote in text 21. Sthira buddhi in text 20. Thank you so much.
Nice work, Mataji.
Will it be possible to have summarize for fifth chapter? I didn't quite get. Basically, it describes about a Krishna conscious person. The whole crowd.
So in the second chapter, it's just the contents of Gita summarized. In the third chapter, Arjuna's question was that, you know, if intelligence is better, then why should I at all act? And Krishna gives Karma Yoga. So the theme or the focus of third chapter was karma, or doing the duties, and Krishna expands on that. The fourth chapter is that all karma yoga should ultimately conclude in transcendental knowledge and how one gets transcendental knowledge. But in the fifth chapter, the emphasis is on renunciation, when you can renounce and what at one point can you renounce, and the qualities of the person who's renounced, who's achieved perfection, and a little bit towards the end into the Dhyana Yoga and on further progress. So that's the fifth, is on the Karma Yoga in Sannyas, or Sannyas Karma Yoga. So the emphasis on renunciation. So that's the gradation it goes.
Yeah.
So third chapter is also called Karma Yoga, and fifth is also called Karma Yoga, Action in Krishna Consciousness. So in third chapter, Yajnarthat Karmanunyatra, it's mentioned karma for the satisfaction of Vishnu. But in the same chapter, demigod sacrifices are also mentioned. So the demigod sacrifices, do they come under yajna or no?
Yes, they come under yajna, because Krishna says that all the yajnas, all the prescribed yajnas are mentioned in Vedas, and Vedas come from the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the demigod sacrifice is a little different, as in it's not done mainly for fruitive results. Here the purpose of all these sacrifices are to getting knowledge of Absolute. So it's a little different than just worshipping quickly demigods for your own results, and then that's it.
In one of the purports of third chapter, Prabhupada says the demigod sacrifices are mentioned or given so such that people can satisfy their perverted desires and at the same time progress. That will gradually cleanse. So my understanding was it was performed for some fruitive result, because the demigods will actually eventually give.
The demigods have two types of mercy. One is a cheating mercy and one is the actual mercy. Especially this is applied to Lord Shiva. We can take it offline, but Lord Shiva, when he gives boons to demons, he just gives them to cheat so that they become more and more antagonistic to the Supreme Lord. But the same Lord Shiva, he guided four Kumaras to the ultimate destination. The four Kumaras had received the mercy. Or is it Navayogendras? One of the two. They received the mercy of Lord Shiva to get to the highest planet. So there are two kinds of mercies given by demigods. So it depends on what is your inclination. So there is a cheating mercy and there is the actual mercy of the demigods. Because demigods are perfectly aware that they are not supreme and Lord Vishnu is the supreme. And the way they can guide their devotees is up to them.
Thank you. So I'm going to cover the next chapter, which is chapter 6 on Dhyana Yoga. And I'm going to move relatively faster here because we have about 45 minutes left and we still have, after that, three more chapters to cover. And I think we should try to observe the timing on that for those who are going to be coming up after this. So I'll mainly cover the cluster of verses that come under Dhyana Yoga that convey a certain meaning. So as Sukheshwari Mataji alluded to in the previous chapter, chapter 5, Krishna outlines this process of eightfold process of Ashtanga Yoga that he will go into detail in chapter 6 and also compare it to Karma Yoga and the process of Krishna consciousness. And he'll point out that the topmost yoga, of course, is practice in Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga. So there are 47 verses in chapter 6. The basic outline, which I explained, is that these various yogas are outlined. Ashtanga yoga is explained in detail. But it is pointed out at the same time that in this age of Kali Yuga, it is difficult to practice this and to attain liberation. Also, there is a component of involvement in material activities and sense gratification that comes in Ashtanga Yoga. A person may practice Ashtanga Yoga and at the same time want to have sense gratification, and that equation as such is not what Krishna would endorse. So that's mentioned at the outset. And the process that is recommended is a form of Karma Yoga. It's acting in Krishna consciousness, doing one's work, doing one's prescribed activities, but not being attached to the fruits of the results, and at the same time thinking about Krishna and focusing one's mind on Krishna. So the first verse outlines all of this, gives in detail what the chapter is about and some of the salient features of this. Then in the next three verses, text 2 to 4, it talks about this yoga ladder. Verse 3 outlines this, starting with Jnana Yoga, then climbing up all the way and ending in Bhakti Yoga, the topmost yoga. For one who is in eightfold Ashtanga Yoga, work is the means, but there is sense gratification also involved. It's work plus sense gratification. Whereas one who is elevated in yoga, at the level practicing Krishna consciousness and in Bhakti Yoga, one is as such renounced. He's not renounced in the sense that he has taken sannyas. He is working, but he is renounced in that he is not attached to the results of the work. He is unattached to that, and he's working essentially for Krishna, not for himself. Next verses, 5 through 7, the role of the mind is talked about. In fact, Krishna goes at length to say that the mind can be at the same time one's best friend or one's enemy, depending on how one uses it. There's a quote from Milton, a famous poet, who had said the mind can be one's best friend or an enemy. It can make a heaven out of hell or hell out of heaven. Similar type of analogy. If one uses it properly, it can be a friend. And if one conquers that, then one can reach the super soul. That's what's pointed out. And the reference to the super soul, of course, comes in that in previous chapters, Krishna has already talked about Sankhya Yoga, the analytical knowledge of the mind, of the body and the soul. And he has explained that the living entity is a spirit soul who is related to the super soul, who is the source. Then in verses 8 to 10, the characteristics of a person practicing yoga, a yogi, are described. What are his characteristics? That person is self-controlled, regards everyone, all living entities, with an equal mind. He's practicing yoga. He's constantly controlling the body, mind, and material activities. A number of verses are dedicated to that from 11 to 15. Then we come into verse 16, where these inhibitors of yoga, rather the deterrents of yoga, are pointing out. Too much sense-gratifying activities are deterrents to that. The two processes are not compatible. They are incompatible. So in order to become well-established in yoga, one needs to regulate one's habits. They may involve controlling all these senses and disciplining one's mental activities. Verses 17 and 19 point that out clearly. And once this is outlined, then Krishna says that one could come to this Brahman platform. It is possible in getting established in yoga by controlling the habits, controlling the mind, or focusing it on the Lord. One can come to Brahman realization, where it's all fortune for the living being. It's a state of bliss. The living entity doesn't want to leave it and thinks that there is no other state better than that state. That's described in verses 20 to 23. Then 24 to 28, this process of yoga is pointed out in a step-by-step fashion. That when one is practicing this, the mind may wander how to bring it back to the self. By practice, one can attain it. And what the other benefits of yoga are, aside from the bliss that one experiences in Brahman realization. A true yogi who is practicing this yoga correctly develops equal vision. Will see all living beings, whether it's a dog, a brahmana, or a cow, equally. Equal vision is one of these benefits or byproducts that will come from practicing this form of yoga. Then moving on further, in text 33 to 34, Arjun will now question this yoga system, because Krishna has said that you need to control all the senses, you need to control mental activities, you need to focus your mind. So Arjun will say, but the mind is restless, it's chanchala and very turbulent. It's difficult to control. He will say that this yoga process is impractical. How do you think it can be really put into practice? So Krishna will say in 35 and 36 that is true, that the mind is unsteady and can wander, but it can be brought under control. The mind can be curbed by practice and detachment. These are the two key terms that Krishna will use to convince Arjuna for this. And one of the analogies that Vaisheshika Prabhu often gives is like, if you want to train a horse, you have to let it go a little bit and then pull again back. And this way, as you practice it, finally the horse will come under control. The mind wants to wander a little bit, let it go, but then you can train it to come back to the center. Okay, so after that, Arjun, being convinced, he will inquire, what is the fate of a person who has been on the spiritual path but has fallen down? One who has given up this spiritual practice. Will he perish and will his practice be of no use? And Krishna replies to him in a cluster of verses 40 to 45 that a transcendentalist who has been engaged on the spiritual path is never overcome by evil. Never, that divine consciousness doesn't go away. The unsuccessful yogi in the next birth will take a birth in a family of righteous people, aristocratic people, or transcendentalists, where he or she will get the opportunity and the resources to revive his or her divine consciousness to begin the process again, and will be soon be able to get caught up with it and achieve complete success. So on the spiritual path, there is really no turning back. And then the chapter ends with verses 46 and 47, which are important verses. They talk about the gradation, the yoga ladder, and the gradation of this yoga system. That a yogi is better than an ascetic, who has no opinion as such about God. And that is better than an empiricist or a philosopher, somebody just mentally speculating, and better than a fruitive worker. And of all yogis, one who practices this yoga prescribed by Sri Krishna with great faith, who thinks of Krishna and renders transcendental service to him, is the highest of all. He is the topmost yogi. So that concludes in verse 47. So, for our Bhakti Shastri, some of the pointers are, text 47 is very important. I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, it was a verse that was given to be memorized, 647. And 647 should be read in detail. The purport is very detailed. It talks about the various yogas and also will give the reasons why Bhakti Yoga, this yoga recommended here, is superior to Ashtanga Yoga and the yoga recommended for this age. So being able to explain this would also be helpful for the exams. So read those purports. That is what I have on 6. Are there any other feedback on 6, chapter 6?
There is one thing I just wanted to, one observation is that in the first verses, Krishna says that those who are on the preliminary stages of this yoga, work is the mean, and for those who are on the advanced stage, cessation of work is the means. Now, in the Dhyana Yoga process, it starts from Yama, Niyama, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, it goes like that. So in the first stage is Yama, means rules and regulations. So one has to act, but with rules and regulations. And in the later stages, when all these Dharana and the postures come, because when Krishna talks about going to a secluded place and staying on a, and getting on a seat and all that, there practically nobody is doing work per se. So if you are reached advanced stage, then you can renounce work. That was just the observations I wanted to make on that particular thing.
Yes, that's a very good point. It comes out in the purports. And also when we use the term renounced, it helps to give some clarification, because renounced in the literal sense is giving up all work, sannyas. Renunciation, sannyas. But Krishna uses the word renounced in another sense, where he's saying that a devotee is working but is not attached to the results. So he's also renounced in that context. And so, yes, it is true that in the gradation, when one gets to the stage of elevated yoga, then work becomes immaterial for the person. We saw that in chapter 3. And Krishna also says that such a person in elevated yoga doesn't have to work, nor is there a reason for him not to work, but he still recommends that being a conditioned soul, he or she work to set an example for others and to lead them onto the path.
In this case, the yogi who's in the forest, yeah, who and Krishna specifically says that they are abstaining from everything, and strictly like living by themselves, they are not setting an example like King Janaka, who was the ruler and yeah, who was ruling his subjects. So there is a little bit of subtle difference, but point well taken.
Yeah, right. In fact, you know, the chapter goes into this mystic yogi and what he is doing, but we also come back to this recommendation that in Kali Yoga, it's difficult to practice what the mystic yogi is practicing. So it is true, yes, that the mystic yogi is not engaged in work and is renounced.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Very nice presentation. Thank you.
So I believe Kishore Prabhu is next. Okay. No. Come up here. Are you connected or? Okay, I'll just turn this off.
I wanted to bring attention to two words, Yoga Ruruksu and Yoga Ruddha. Those are the two words used in chapter 6.
Which verse is that?
Third verse, 6.3.
Oh, 6.3, okay.
And in one of the lectures, Srivas Prabhu said, Yoga Ruruksa stage is up to Pratyahara. And Yoga Ruddha is after that, what is that, Dharana and Dhyan. So, and also he mentioned, I want to recollect that, up to that beginning stage, one is to still work. And after that, it's a true renunciation, because he has already he's already renunciated. He is clear. Basically, everything is basically he's desireless, materially desirelessness. So
that's right. It actually reinforces the same point that was made. Thank you.
Prabhuji, before I start, I had the question on why is it called fruitive activity in the initial stages? Yoga Ruruksu and Yoga Rudha. So initially they practice postures, you know, to breathing practices and all. It's also part of attaining the Supreme, isn't it? As well as, you know, sitting and on the kusha grass on a soft cloth. It's also the activity to attain realize the Supreme. Why is it called initially fruitive activity and later it is not?
No, it's nothing to do with fruitive activity. It is work and cessation of work. Do you go to office or do you forget office, go to Himalayas? That's the point.
Is it fruitive or not?
No, the thing is work with rules and regulations, it's not fruitive. It's like a stepping stone. I use work to reach a certain level and after that give up work, just like a ladder. You use the ladder to climb up on the roof and then you can throw away the ladder. It's a different story whether you can come back or not. That's a different thing. But
in one of the purports to these verses, Prabhupada says the activity that you perform, the work you perform in the initial stages, they are fruitive.
Fruitive in the sense like there sakama karma and nishkam karma. The fruit is there, but whether you are offering the fruit to the Lord or whether you are trying to enjoy the fruit.
Yeah, I mean, whenever we hear of this term fruitive activity, that means it is for us. If that is the case, even after they attain the Yoga Ruruddha stage, that is also fruitive, right? They are not helping others, if going by your definition.
So, okay, let's go see the purport. What purport exactly you are saying where Prabhupada is saying this? Let's read it. Probably it will give us a better understanding.
What is the verse? What is the verse in question?
6.3.
It's on pay. It's purport to 6.3, paragraph 2. Concerning the Eightfold Yoga System, attempts in the beginning to enter into meditation through regulative principles of life and practice of different sitting postures, which are more or less bodily exercises, are considered fruitive material activities. All such activities lead to achieving perfect mental equilibrium to control the senses.
The point is that if you are just doing it for the sake of doing, then they are just fruitive activities. It won't help you lead to further advancement. But with the goal is to achieve yoga ruruksha stage, to achieve dhyana, then these are going to propel you towards that. For example, people who are going to yoga societies, they are doing all these things, breathing exercises and sitting postures. Is that a fruitive activity or is it a spiritual activity? Fruitive. Because they don't have that knowledge or the goal for that. But if the goal is persisted through these activities, which are initially fruitive, then they lead you to the transcendental plane.
So if you know the goal and do these activities, they are not fruitive.
Correct. Correct. In dhyana is Paramatma realization. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is there. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, talking to Sanatana Goswami, he says that the jnanis realize Brahman, and then the yogis or dhyana yogis realize Paramatma, and bhaktis realize Krishna.
Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamini Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschachade Starane Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Brinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So before we begin chapter 7, Rakshit Prabhu was explaining in the last verse of chapter 6, Krishna says the best form of yoga that you can practice is by becoming a devotee and becoming Krishna conscious. So with that in mind, Krishna begins 7th chapter, and in the 7th chapter Krishna explains how one can become that best yogi that he was explaining in the end of the 6th chapter. So he starts from the highest concept of how to become a pure devotee, how to get a complete knowledge of Krishna consciousness, and first and second verses talk about that process, like concentrating the mind on Krishna. The words maya sattamana means concentrating the mind on Krishna, and he is also using the word shrunu, means hear. So it also means hearing from his representative, not just from Krishna. It's equally as good as hearing from Krishna. And also, I think the last part is missing here. So madashraya, there is also another word. He's concentrating on the importance of taking shelter in Krishna consciousness. So the actual translation of madashraya means in Krishna consciousness. So he is stressing these different aspects one should concentrate to get complete knowledge of Krishna consciousness. And once you get that complete knowledge, what is your position? Once a devotee gets this complete knowledge, he becomes pure. And such a devotee is very rare. And Krishna tells a verse which epitomizes this concept. Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschit yatati siddhaye. There are thousands of men who are, you know, doing various things. Out of them, hardly one may try to achieve for perfection. And even though one may achieve material perfection, or even though one may achieve spiritually perfection in attaining realization of impersonal Brahman or Paramatma realization, one may still cannot understand Krishna as he is. So a pure devotee with complete knowledge is very rare, and only he can understand Krishna. And seen what is the position of a pure devotee, Krishna says that a devotee of that stature should know both phenomenal and numinous. So that means the phenomenal world which we can perceive with our senses, and the source or the spirit behind it, and the source of both of them. So the source of both of them is Krishna. When I say both, one is this material world, and Purusha avataras, Vishnu, or in specific in our universe, who is maintaining Garbhodaksai Vishnu, because of which this phenomenal world exists and is maintained. Krishna is the source of both of them. So when he says phenomenal and numinous, we should be able to know both this manifestations of material energy as well as the source behind it. And Krishna says that he is the supreme. How he is the origin of both material and spiritual energies. Mattah Partram Nanyat Kinchidasi Dhananjaya. Also, there are verses saying he is the origin of both spiritual as whoever comes into being, the spirit soul, has its nature in both spiritual energy and material energy. And then Krishna goes on explaining his all-pervasiveness in this material world. This is part of the phenomenal knowledge that he was mentioning in the second verse. So he says he is the taste of water, and he is the intelligence of the intelligent, he is the prowess of the powerful. By all these means, he was trying to explain his all-pervasiveness in various aspects of the material world. So those who cannot perceive him personally, they can try to realize him through these various aspects. So they are covered in 8 to 11. Krishna says he is not under the modes of material nature. Now, having explained various all-pervasiveness aspects of the material world, one may think that he is part of this material world and he may be influenced by these modes of material nature. But Krishna categorically denies, states that he is not under the modes, whereas the modes are under him. It's a very important verse which we can use in preaching also. Echaiva sattvika bhava tamasas rajasastaye matta eveti tanviti natvam teshu temai. So they are under me and I am not working under them. And because of these three modes, the whole world is actually deluded, and they do not know me because of the influence of the three modes. And the verse is Tribhir Gunamayair Bhavair Ebi Sarvam Idam Jagat Mohitam Nabi Janati Mamebhyam Paramaveyam. So Krishna is explaining how these three modes are acting on people and how he is not under these three modes. And in 14th verse, having explained how these modes of material nature work and how they do not know Krishna because of this, he is giving a formula wherein one can come out of this influence of modes of material nature and attain beyond these modes of material nature. That is the verse Daivihi Esha Gunamai. So by the simple process of surrendering to Krishna, one can get beyond the clutches of the modes of material nature. And there are a few points mentioned in Prabhupada's purport, one of them being, if the living entity is superior energy, which has been told earlier, aparayam itastvanyam prakritim vidhime param, then why he cannot overcome the inferior material energy? That is one point Prabhupada raises in the purport. And he answers that by saying that even though it is inferior energy, it is conducted by the divine will of the Supreme Person. So that is why it is, unless Krishna orders the material energy to release the soul, he cannot be released. And also, that is the same reason why this inferior nature is also called divine, because it is conducted by the divine will of the Supreme Person. So, and also importantly, Prabhupada mentions the position of a bona fide spiritual master in this connection. He brings up a concept of guna or rope. Guna is also called rope. Daivishyesha gunamai. The word guna refers to rope also. So a living entity, if he is bound by a rope and if he wants to be disentangled from that binding, another living entity which is bound by a rope cannot come and help him. So the rescuer must be liberated. So he says that the bona fide representative of Krishna, the spiritual master, must be liberated if he at all can help any conditioned living entity. And Very importantly, in the last paragraph of the same verse, he says that even the personalities in the position of Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, they are under the influence of Maya and they cannot award liberation. So just imagine the position of a bona fide spiritual master who has to be, whose position is even greater than Brahma and Shiva in order to save the spirit soul. And after having said how to get out of this bondage of material nature, Krishna explains four classes of people who don't surrender, who don't take this simple process of surrender and try to perpetually live in this material world. He mentions he says they are called miscreants or duskritina. Kriti means performance of meritorious activities. Duskriti means the same performance in the opposite direction, which is opposing the plan of the Lord. So they are called duskritina, and Krishna categorically says they are four in number. One is Mudha, and one is Naradhama, one is Maya Paharita Jnana, and the fourth one is Asuram Bhava Mashrita. So Krishna and Prabhupada in his purport very detailedly explains all these four classes of men. Mudha means basically, it's like literal word is ass, who just works for his master without earning much benefit. He knows that there is a grass freely available, but still he thinks that only his master can feed him. And without knowing that he cannot enjoy much even after working, he keeps working like software engineer who spends hours of night without knowing that he'll get ulcers and he cannot enjoy proper food later. So that is just one example of many. Then second class is Naradhama. Basically they are 99.9% Prabhupada says of the whole world is Naradhama, because having gotten this human form of life, they do not utilize that form to achieve Krishna consciousness. So that is why Krishna categorically states that they are Naradhamas, because they are wasting their human form. And there are also multiple descriptions given about Naradhamas. And one example of Naradhama, Prabhupada says, it is Jaga and Madhai. And how they only by the mercy of a pure devotee can they be saved. Like in this case, Nityananda Prabhu. And then there are Maya Pahrita Jnanas, who are, deluded, impersonal speculators. They say Krishna is not having personal form. They are basically mental speculators who do not have any parampara or disciplic succession, and they try to speculate and understand the absolute truth. And then finally, the fourth class is Asuram Bhava Mashrita. They are basically openly atheistic. They actually take pleasure in openly announcing that I am an atheist. You might have come across a lot of people like that. It's becoming a fashion nowadays. I am atheist. So they are basically Asuram Bhava Mashrita. If you can, I would suggest strongly to read this purport. There are multiple points mentioned, and it's a potential candidate for Bhakti Shastri question with a lot of marks. So you have to take note of each of these points mentioned under this classes of people who don't surrender to Krishna. And then having said people who don't surrender to Krishna, Krishna comes to four classes of people who are pious and gradually come to the point of surrender. One is Artha, means Artha actually. It's there are people having distress, material distress. They want to get rid of distress and come to Krishna. Then there is Jignasu, who means inquisitive people. And then there is people who seek for wealth, and Jnani, who are seeking for the knowledge of absolute. So another famous verse, Chaturvidha Bhajante Mam, 7.16. So these four classes of people come to Krishna because of one of these reasons. And by associating with a pure devotee, when they come to Krishna consciousness, their material desires gradually vanish and they also become pure. Are all of them great souls? Because they have material desires, because in Krishna consciousness, the basic philosophy is we should not aspire for material desires. So the question comes, are these great souls? The answer is yes, Krishna himself says, but of all of them, one who is purely looking for knowledge in Krishna consciousness, and serving Krishna always, Krishna regards them as the best. but he does not condemn the other people. He still says they are great Mahatmas. Prabhupada uses the word Mahatma in the purport and explains that gradually they will become pure and come to the point of pure devotees. So these four classes at last surrender to Krishna after many, many births. Again, this famous verse, Bahunam Janmanamante, which we use a lot of times in our preaching and other things. So these four classes, if they come to the point of Krishna somehow or the other, gradually they come and surrender to Krishna. Apart from these people, there are less intelligent people who don't surrender, like the fruitive workers. They just take to demigod worship. So verses 7.20 to 23 actually concentrate on demigod worship, how the less intelligent people who aspire for fruitive results take to demigod worship and don't surrender to Krishna, and how Krishna actually guides them to worship a particular demigod, and how their faith is stabilized because of the super soul, and how they achieve the results, and how the results are temporary. All these points are mentioned in these three or four verses. But the pure devotees don't ask any material benefits from Krishna. And in fact, it is said in one of the purports that Krishna does not award material benefits to his pure devotees, which are desired by the fruity workers and other classes of pious people, because it will take him away from pure devotional service. So the other classes of less intelligent people are these speculators who speculate on the Vedanta, and they say that the ultimate absolute truth is impersonal. And they derive their own imperfect theories about absolute truth. They say that absolute truth is impersonal, and now they have assumed the form of Krishna. So when absolute truth is under the influence of Maya, he takes different roles. It takes different roles of Krishna, Rama and things like that. And Krishna condemns such theories, and it's a very important purport, very nice purport. Prabhupada explains how to defeat the impersonal Mayavadis with this verse. So having said all these different varieties of people, those who surrender, those who are pious, those who are less intelligent, those who don't surrender, Krishna says that what is the advantage of those who are surrendered and disadvantage of those who are not surrendered. So Krishna says he doesn't manifest to those who are not surrendered. Naham prakasha sarvasya yogamaya samavrutaha. So because of the internal potency which covers him, he cannot be properly seen as he is by people who don't surrender to him. And hence no one can know him other than his devotees. So only devotees can know him. So the mam tu veda na kaschana in verse 7.26 says no one actually can know Krishna who knows past, present and future of everyone. Now this specifically means, when he says no one can know me, this specifically means these speculators, these jnanis and paramatma realized people, or even fruity workers, they cannot know Krishna as he is. Only the devotees can know. And then Krishna says, in general, why living entities don't come to Krishna consciousness? It is answered in 7.27th verse. It is because they are bewildered by dualities arising from desire and hate. Even in the normal day-to-day work, we see we like something and we don't like something. We like someone and we don't like someone. Some of our devotees were looking for matches for their marriage, and they like someone and they don't like someone. It's all desire and hate. In the material world, if there is desire, that means you have to hate someone. And if there is a man, there is a woman, and there is a happiness, there has to be a distress. So this material world is manifested in terms of a duality. So that is why the living entities cannot understand what is Krishna consciousness. So, and then Krishna says, who can come to Krishna consciousness and serve Krishna? Esham Tvantagatam Papam, whose sinful reactions have been destroyed, and who have acted piously in this life and in previous lives, and who are freed from these dualities that Krishna mentioned earlier, they can come to Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada also talks about the importance of association of devotees in this purport. So having cleansed their sinful reactions, what do they do? So this verse 7.29 says, They take refuge in Krishna in devotional service. Jara marana mokshaya mam ashritya yatantiye. Te brahma tadviduh krishnam adhyatmam karma chakilam. And Prabhupada says that only devotees can be called Brahman. And other classes of people like impersonalists, they cannot be called Brahma because they do not know the ultimate goal is Krishna Loka. And then whoever is practicing this devotional service, what happens to them at the end, at the time of death? It is stated in the last verse of this chapter. He can understand and know me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even at the time of death. So that is the last verse. Ultimately, he attains Dhruvavrata, determined faith in pure devotional service, and it is the beginning of Bhakti Yoga, wherein all transcendental devotional activities start. So in conclusion, the seventh chapter particularly explains how one can become a fully Krishna conscious person. Thank you. Can everyone please move forward, please, to accommodate people behind?
Hare Krishna. Is everybody doing okay? Yeah. Just for those who have come late or who joined late, in case you are wondering why is there a rotation of speakers going on like this and who is actually the speaker for Sunday feast and such, if such mysteries are cropping up, it's just we are having a this is a Bhakti Shastri course which we offer at ISKCON Silicon Valley, which is a systematic study of Srila Prabhupada's books. And next week we are having an exam for all the 9 chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So this Sunday we are just doing a quick overview of all the 9 chapters. So the students have taken up to present one chapter of or few chapters, whatever they can, of Bhagavad Gita. So... that's a little bit of background for those who have just joined. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shilakhaya Chakshur Unmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. So we are continuing with the 8th chapter, and in the end of 7th chapter, Krishna says that at the time of death, and then the 8th chapter, Arjuna asks 8 questions. Sadhi Bhuta. So he asks, like, who is the, if you turn to the page. Page 365. Then Arjuna asks 8 questions in the verse. In the first 2 verses, actually. So Arjuna inquired, O my Lord, O Supreme Person, what's Brahman, what is Self? What is fruitive activities? What is this material manifestation? And what are the demigods? Please explain this to me. Who is the Lord of sacrifice? And how does he live in the body, O Madhusudana? And how can those engaged in devotional service know you at the time of death? So Krishna answers all the 7 questions in the 3rd verse. He doesn't waste much time. Then he extensively dwells on the topic of death. Because Krishna discusses in the 2nd chapter that those who are born will die and those who die have to take birth again. So the 8th chapter describes the dynamics of death. And so he mentions about who's going to die, and or everybody is going to die, but what's the consciousness? For example, an impersonalist, if he's going to die, then he has certain set of activities. He has to utter Omkara, and there are certain ways. And this chapter is aimed at all classes of persons, the impersonalists, the karmakandis, and the devotees. And the Lord says, for the devotees, how can they remember me, and what's the destination? So if you go and read the few important topics are especially are text 5 and text 6. Antakale chamameva smaran muktva kalevaram ya prayati samadbhavam yati nasyatra samshaya. And whoever at the end of this life quits his body remembering me alone at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. And in the next verse he says that whatever one thinks of at the time of death, then one attains that stage. And if we keep on going, seeing the verses, then in text 7, and text 8, text 9, the Lord says, how can one think of him? And so he in 9, he says, one should meditate upon me as the Supreme Person who knows everything. He who is the oldest, who is the controller, who is smaller than the smallest, who is the maintainer of everything, and who is beyond all material conception, who is inconceivable and who is always a person. He is luminous like a sun, and he is transcendental beyond this material nature. So in ten different ways the Lord says that one can meditate upon him. And then for the 10th, 11th, and 12th, 13th, so these three verses, they describe the jnana yogi, that they have to strictly practice and they have to raise the body, the chakras. There is life air through different chakras, and through the Brahmarandhra and the top, they leave. When they can choose when they want to quit the body, and they can leave at that point of time. But Krishna again intersperses with the next verse. He says that one who remembers me with undeviated attention, then one will attain me at the time of death. So this is the verse 14. Then 15 kind of says, 15 and 16, they talk of the return. So one who goes to the Lord, he doesn't return back to this material world. But one who one who goes to the higher planetary systems, then one returns back again. He says, Abrahma bhuvana loka punaravritano vachana mamapetitu kauntiya punarjanmana vidyate. That even one goes to the highest planet, from the highest planet Brahmaloka down to the lowest planet, there is repeated birth and death. So if one thinks that if I can get better position, then I am happy. No, Krishna says, no, it's not going to work. Just as you have a credit card, you max it out, then you are in trouble. You have to start paying debts. Similarly, you run out your good karma, you have to come back again. And then a little bit of Brahmaji's history and his activities are given, and how he has a very, very long life. And then he says that at the time of Brahma's night, that is annihilation, then everybody has to merge back into the body of Vishnu. And then he talks about his own nature a little bit. The text 20, parastasmatu bhavonyo vyakto vyaktat sanatana yasa sarveshu bhuteshu nasyastu navinashvati. Yet there is another unmanifested nature, which is eternal, which is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. And then Krishna kind of goes on a little bit telling about his spiritual nature, on how spiritual nature is different from material nature. From text 23 on to all the way up to 26, the Lord gives two different ways of passing from this material world. One is the path of light and one is the path of darkness. So if you see, if you try to have your own death, or you want to die, because yogis can control when they want to die, and they have to choose an exactly right time, and everything has to be properly aligned. The 6 months Uttarayan, Dakshinayan has to be aligned. Then Shukla Paksha or Krishna Paksha has to be aligned. Then there has to be perfect timing in which it has to be aligned. Otherwise, what happens is, if you go in the darkness, then you'll come back again. If you go in the light, you won't come back. There's a chance. But Krishna says, you know what?
Really? You want to try this lottery system? Don't try that. You know, he says in text 27, although the devotees know these two paths, O Arjuna, they are never bewildered because they are always fixed in devotion. And Krishna says earlier that those who are fixed in devotion, that they come to him easily without any problems. So it's better one remains in devotional service. Easy. You know, one doesn't have to take chances. Luck with time. And the last verse is a pretty important verse, and it says, Vedeshu yajneshu tapasu chaiva daneshu yat punya phalam pradishtam atyeti tat sarvam idam viditva yogi paramsthanam upaiti chadyam. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing sacrifices, undergoing austerities, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical or fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end, he reaches for the supreme eternal abode. Nice, isn't it? Chanting Hare Krishna, you get everything. Why do you really want to try other stuff? Stuff. But Mahaprabhu made it very easy. You chant, you get the results. Whatever the results one has to try from other processes, one gets nicely. I'm very sorry that we are rushing through because of the time limit. And thank you very much. Any questions? Last 1-2 minutes of questions, or we can go on with the chapter 9, which our very own Ramananda Sakar Prabhu is going to tell. Yeah, you should. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
अज्ञानातिमिरांधश्च ज्ञानांजनाशलाकया चक्षुर उन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः. भगवत गीता चैप्टर 9, द टाइटल ऑफ दिस चैप्टर इज द मोस्ट कॉन्फिडेंशियल नॉलेज. इन द पर्पोट्स प्रभुपाद एक्सप्लेन्स दैट चैप्टर 1 इज काइंड ऑफ एन इंट्रोडक्टरी, sets the introductory scene to the Bhagavad Gita, and chapter 2 and 3 are confidential because the confidential knowledge is described in those two chapters. Chapter 7 and 8 are even more confidential, and chapter 9 is the most confidential. As we can see in this chapter, the first three verses, Krishna tells Arjuna that this is the secret of this knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets, and he selected Arjuna because he is a dear friend as well as a devotee also. The next set of verses give kind of Krishna's mystic opulence. He goes on saying that he is in his unmanifested form, he pervades the entire universe. Everything is resting in him, and yet also everything is not also resting in him. It's hard to understand how everything rests in him and also everything is also not resting him at the same time, but that is Krishna's the mystic opulence, where everything is situated in him, at the same time he is also separately situated on his own planet. Then he goes on saying how he is the controller of all the material energy, how the whole cosmic manifestation is working under his energy and under his will. It's created and annihilated and again and again. But Krishna, he says that he's detached from all these activities. seated as though he's neutral. Then the next set of next few verses, they talk about how fools about the fools and the devotees. He says that fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the supreme lord of all that be. Krishna is disclosing this to Arjuna because he is the most intimate friend, and he is telling him that coming to this material world is not an easy thing, because who wants to go to a place where he gets derided, for example? No one likes to go to that place. And Krishna, he's also a person. He doesn't like to come here because fools deride him always. And he has to tolerate all that. On the other hand, there are other set of... there are a set of people called devotees who worship him with great devotion, and they perpetually worship him with great devotion. In other parts of the Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned that it is for this reason, to give pleasure to the devotees, he is coming. But in that process, he has to bear everything done by non-devotees. The next set of verses, they talk about. They talk about this. They also kind of talk about Krishna's opulences. He says that in other parts of the Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned that how different people who are attracted to Vedas, they follow all the rituals mentioned in the Vedas to attain the heavenly planets. But here in this verse, because this is the most confidential knowledge, he's saying that, but I am the ritual, I am the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, the transcendental chant, and the butter and the fire and the offering. In other words, whatever sacrifices that are mentioned in the Vedas, those sacrifices and all the ingredients for the sacrifices that are Krishna himself. The next few verses, they say, you know, Krishna is a father of the universe, he is the mother of the universe, he is also the Vedas. But interestingly, here it is on the name, he talks about, I am the Samaveda, Yajurveda, and Rigveda, but the name of other Veda is not mentioned. That I don't know why, but that is not mentioned here. The next set of, again, the verses, they go into a kind of a demigod worship. Those who seek heavenly planets and those who study the Vedas and drink the Soma juice seeking the heavenly planets, he says that Krishna, they're worshipping Krishna indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. But their pleasures are not permanent. As soon as the results of their pious activities are finished, they again have to come back to this mortal planet again, and then take birth as a human being or any other living beings here. But those who constantly meditate on Krishna, to them, Krishna says he is going to carry what they lack and he preserves what they have. This is one of the key verses here, because that is not the case for the demigod worshippers. You know, their results is granted, and as soon as their pious activities are finished, they again come back to this material world. But in the case of Krishna, he is telling Arjuna that I preserve what his dearest devotees have, and also supply what they lack. Uh, Then, you know, the next few verses, it is said that those who worship demigods will take birth among the demigods, and those who worship ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings, and those who worship me will live with me. So in the purport, Prabhupada says, if a person worships some demigod, he goes to demigod. If a person worships ghosts, he takes birth among such beings. Then why not if a person worships Krishna, he doesn't go to Krishna's planet? So if a person worships Krishna, then he goes to Krishna's planet, where life is full of eternal bliss and full of knowledge. The next set of few verses, they go into kind of a devotional service. It starts with, if one offers me with love, with love and devotion, a leaf, a flower, fruit or water, I will accept it. This verse cannot be applied to something impersonal, because what kind of exchange we can have by offering a leaf or a flower to an impersonal entity? So this verse clearly says that Krishna has a personality, and he accepts even a little offering such as the leaf or a flower or a fruit of a water offered with devotion. So next verse is 927, which is one of my favorite, which is, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. This is practically what ISKCON, you know, teaches in this Krishna conscious movement, that whatever all the activities we do it in the spirit of as an offering to Krishna. And these activities, if we do that way, then we become free from all results of auspicious and inauspicious activities, and then we get liberated. The next set of few verses, they talk about devotees who might accidentally commit some mistakes. Krishna says, if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly, for he is properly situated in his determination. This verse tells how Krishna cares about his devotees, that he is willing to excuse even the most abominable actions. It's not just an abominable action, the most abominable actions done by pure devotees, if they are situated in pure devotional service. However, in the purport, Prabhupada explains that these are applicable to the accidental mistakes, not that one commits purposefully and then expects Krishna to excuse them. No, not those things. By the power of devotional service, again, he quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. And then Krishna asks Arjun to declare that my devotee never perishes. Again, at some other places, there is, Prabhupada says why he asks Arjuna to declare it instead of Krishna declaring it himself. Because it was seen that Krishna sometimes go against his own words. And he is asking Arjuna to declare it because Arjuna is his dearest devotee. And if a dearest devotee declares it, then Krishna makes sure that whatever he said comes to be true. Then he says, you know, those who take shelter of him, even though they take of lower birth, such as women, vices, and shudras, can attain the supreme destination. But in the purport, Prabhupada says, not only Shudras, even those who are less than the Shudras, like Chandalas, dog-eaters, even they can also become perfect, and they can also go back to Godhead by just following the devotional practices. The last verse for me, it's kind of a sum and substance of the Bhagavad Gita, which says that engage your mind always in thinking of me, become my devotee, offer obeisances to me and worship me. Being completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me. So this is like a summon substance of Bhagavad Gita in just one verse. And whatever is mentioned in this chapter, it's really in one way easy to do. It's not a very difficult thing to do all these things. But still, because of external energy, we are so much bewildered that it's very difficult. That's all I have.
Question.
Yeah, you can go ahead.
Hare Krishna. So I just have a small question. Isn't that Bhagavad Gita and including chapter 9 is an open secret? And if that's true, what's the significance of chapter 9 being titled as the most confidential knowledge? And you also said that chapter 7 and 8, as it's written in the purport, that's also confidential. So what's the significance about this?
Yeah, it's we call it as an open secret. It's open, but it's a mystery. Because even though this knowledge is openly available, first of all, there are only few who even attempt to read Bhagavad Gita. Very few. And then out of those few who read Bhagavad Gita, even very small percentage of them, they actually read the Bhagavad Gita according to the proper conclusions given by the bona fide teachers. So, and then even after reading them, you know, it's not the academic knowledge that matters. It's actually the realization that matters. So, when Krishna is saying most confidential, this is he's talking about the knowledge not just as a matter of not an academic basis. It's in terms of realization. It's very, very confidential. Unless one realizes it, he cannot understand the significance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ramananda. And thanks to all the speakers who participated.